there might well be some people still running here. So,
if you think we must proceed, let's do so. Yeah, no, 15 minutes is too long to still wait. We will proceed. Good morning again. Okay. We'll switch off now. This morning, we requested that the department would speak to us about the urban agenda, and they promised to do so. Now, we had originally we were originally expecting the minister to be here this morning. Unfortunately, this morning we received a note saying that he won't be able to make it. Unfortunately, things have come up out of his control, so he's not able to be here with us. And so what I decided is that I would then request the department itself to start, because they on the urban agenda, and then we'll get to hear the local government sitter. Are they here?
Not yet. MDB is here.
All the better that we start. You see, Sidwell Mufokeng threatened to, or rather, wanted to be the first in the morning, and he's not here. Okay, and then after that, we would give to the demarcation board, and then the CRL commission to wrap it up for us nicely. Our intention is not to go beyond lunch. And we would like to have as rich a discussion as we had yesterday. So please be mindful of that. All of you who are going to speak, we do want each of the presenters to receive as much attention by way of question and discussion as we gave yesterday. So let's be mindful of the time we spend. So this one, I thought it's important to us to add to the work that we wanted to hear from the department, so that we are fully briefed, and also for it's an ongoing process to keep us up to date with critical dynamics that impact on the work that we have to oversee in the department. So with those few words, thank you very much and welcome. Nelly, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Patel is going to go through the presentation, and then I would speak towards the end on education.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yeah, because they said it's you and him, so no. Okay, that's all right. Go ahead, Yusuf. It's that side, on your left. On your right,
Alan. Thanks, Chairperson, honorable members.
Copies of this presentation are being made. The excuse is that, you see, we asked them to do this overnight, so they couldn't manage an overnight efficiency. So the copies are delayed. They'll be coming anyway. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Chairperson. Honorable members, colleagues, we'll just share some...
Please protest if you don't hear. Just raise your hand. I'll know that it's because you don't hear. All right, thanks.
Okay, we really will be sharing just some brief background, but mainly focus on the key findings from the research that we undertook to prepare a National Urban Development Framework. So what we're presenting is not the National Urban Development Framework as such. That still has to be completed, but we've undertaken a research exercise. And that's what we'll be sharing really today. Maybe just to emphasize that this work is one of the action items on the 5-year local government strategic agenda. It has been undertaken in 3 phases. So we've completed the research phase now. And then we'll be going on to a more detailed consultation and drafting phase, and then hopefully the publication and implementation. But also just to say that we've been working as a department together with the presidency, and we've been supported by the South African Cities Network in this particular phase of the work. And there's also a complementary rural development framework that's currently being developed, and both the urban and rural framework will be aligned under the new national planning system that has been established. And obviously, as Elroy mentioned yesterday, there'll be a cabinet discussion on that next week. So really what we're sharing with the portfolio committee is really the main findings of this research. Now, again, there's a lot of detail and a whole lot of documents that have been prepared, but just to try and summarize what's coming out of the research, there's really three overarching points. I think firstly that there's a rapidly growing urban population, but at the same time there's large numbers of people that continue to live in dense rural areas. And the second major trend is that there's a concentration of economic activity in what we terming city regions, and I'll come to some of the definitions later. But at the same time, while there's a concentration of activity in these city regions, there's also high levels of poverty in these areas. And then the third major trend is that there's major service delivery demands and pressures being placed on our large cities and metropolitan areas. So just to unpack some of those trends quickly, the first one around the rapidly growing urban population, there's definitely continued urbanization, and we're finding this net growth of the city regions and cities, major regional centers. There's out-migration from the central parts of the country and even from the traditionally densely populated coastal districts that's around KZN, Eastern Cape. And then there's a change in demographic profile. So we're finding that most of the people moving as well into the cities are younger and poorer. But as I mentioned earlier, there's still a large number of people that continue to remain in some of the densely settled former homeland areas. And this is mainly due to the natural growth of those areas. Now, this map really just sort of gives a representation of what I've indicated in terms of some of these trends. So if you look at what the map is really saying is that the red areas on the map are the high density cores. So these are really your where we have your major metropolitan and your large cities. And if you look at the blue line, means that 88% of economic activity is concentrated in those red areas. So that just gives you the kind of description, visual description of those trends. And then 71% of the population live in those red areas, that's in your high-density cores, and it makes up only 7% of the surface area of the country. And the trend is similar, I mean, you can pick up. So the issue really is we've been able to now map this, in quite amount of detail. And it's giving us a very useful indication of how the spread of the population across the country is, but also, you know, what's really happening in a more dynamic sense. So this map really shows the purple areas begin to show those areas that are now experiencing population growth between that time period 2001-2007, and the blue areas shows areas that have where there's been population decline. So it gives you an indication of where people are moving out of and where they're moving towards. The second trend around the concentration of economic activity, clearly there is major concentration, in the city regions. So this is where your job growth is taking place and economic diversification and innovation. There's economic opportunities and livelihoods being concentrated in those areas. you know, relative to the other areas. I mean, we're finding that also many people are moving to the city regions, etc., but are not necessarily finding livelihood opportunities. But at the same time, there's a better chance of finding livelihood opportunities in some of the cities than other parts of the country. And then I think the other important point is that these cities, and that's why this whole issue of city regions becomes important, because the cities and towns don't exist. You know, the economic system doesn't just function via these administrative boundaries. The economies extend beyond the administrative boundaries. So the cities, the towns, the hinterlands form part of an interconnected system, and taking those linkages into account is quite important. I mean, the example, for example, in Cape Town, you know, the water comes from Stellenbosch. It sits outside of the city as a metro. So those kinds of linkages are also quite important. And therefore, the concept of city regions also is beginning to emerge as an important concept. This is just showing that particular map. It's indicating the level of concentration of the economy, but also the fact that the tertiary sector of the economy is more dominant in these major cities. And the tertiary sector refers to, you know, finance, construction, wholesale, transportation. So it's important. It gives an indication of the characteristic of our economy and how that's also changing and transforming. And then the...
Can we just see what the figures mean? I mean, what do the different colors mean?
Well, basically, if you look at where you see those bars, they're basically prominent in those areas, Johannesburg and the other metros in Gauteng, Etiquini, Nelson Mandela, and Cape Town, for example. But what those bars are actually talking to, the different colors are the different economic sectors. So the brown one would be finance, and then the light green would be wholesale, the dark green would be transport. But it's just giving the contribution to GDP of those sectors. Yeah, so it's just giving you the contribution. they're heeding our call for cooperative governance. So, so I think it's just giving the magnitude. So you can see this is actually, you know, the Gauteng and the metro there. So it's giving the magnitude of the role of the financial sector in that economy. The last trend is around service delivery demands and pressures. And I think here we're finding that whilst all this economic activity, et cetera, is concentrated in the urban areas, there's still major service delivery backlogs in these areas and major pressures in terms of natural resources, land capability, et cetera. And I think this next map also begins to show some of these pressures. The blue areas here are the concentration of informal settlements in the country. So you can see, you know, that's the kind of numbers you're dealing with. I'm talking about it's between over 300,000 people living in informal settlements concentrated in the blue areas, so as opposed to, you know, the rest of the country. So they're just giving you that indication, but also what's important, looking at the, you know, the ecological issues we were discussing yesterday and the issues around our natural resources, and that this begins to show some of the pressures that your major cities are going to come under. So, for example, currently, that's as at the year 2000, the green would indicate that these are water catchment areas, right? So they're not municipal boundaries or that. So the green would indicate that in this water catchment area, you know, the bar is slightly up, so it means that there's sufficient water supply for that area. But if you take a low growth scenario, by 2025, we may be, you still would have, you know, perhaps sufficient water supply, and even 2025, That would be the water demand, the need for water in that area. But there is a sufficiency. But as opposed to the upper Vaal, for example, you can see this is actually, the graph goes in the other direction. That means this will be a negative supply of water by 2025 if you take a high population and high demand scenario. So currently the upper Vaal, which actually supplies large part of Gauteng, etc., currently, but in the year 2000, it's just sort of breaking even. But if we took it, if we take the two growth scenarios, high and low, by 2025, you can see the possible pressures that we're under. So that area, this area in Mvoti, which looked at also at the Queenie area, look at Cape Town as well. So just showing some of these major metros where your large populations are concentrated and economic activity is concentrated, you can see the water supply situation. And then I think what this explains, it just summarizes the overall research that was done, because what the research now pointed to is that we were able to put together a more, a clearer typology of and definition of the urban areas. And if we look at the Gauteng city region, for example, 22% of the country's population is concentrated there. It contributes 39% to the economy, and 13% of poor people in the country live in Gauteng. So that's basically what it's telling you. But this is really the typology. So it is the Gauteng city region, which is the largest, and then the coastal city regions would be Cape Town, Nelson Mandela Bay, and Etiquini, making up 16% of the population. These would be the secondary cities. These would be regional service centers, service towns, local and niche settlements. Now, basically 72% of the country's population live within these settlements. And then importantly, it makes up 94% of the economic activity, and 60% of the country's poor are actually living in these areas. And then the rest of the country is made up of these the dispersed rural settlements, including some of those dense former homeland areas and your farms, which make up the remainder 28% of the population, where 40% of the poor are concentrated. So I think this, you know, gives a very nice summary of what the actual picture is in terms of poverty levels, how poverty spread across the country, but also the economic levels. But what it also points to is that there needs to be an important relationship between the urban and rural development. These settlements are all interlinked. So some of these service towns, niche settlements, are actually within broader rural regions. And within some of these more dense rural areas, you're actually finding very dense settlements emerging and potential for actually new cities and that to be formalized and developed. So the issue is really providing the landscape, but I think the interlinkages between the rural and urban are becoming more and more pronounced through this kind of typology. This really just gives an explanation of the characteristics of these different areas. They do have different characteristics. Your city regions, for example, are much more globally connected as opposed to some of the other areas. But these are examples of, so when we talk of these cities, we're talking of areas like Polokwane, Bloemfontein, Nelspruit, these regional service centers. You're looking at areas like Tata, Toyando, Rustenburg. The service towns are typically areas like Giyani, Escort in the KwaZulu-Natal, and your local niche towns are towns like Prince Albert or Alice. And even within each of these areas, you can see there's a differentiation. So your local niche towns, you have some small towns with high economic growth like Prince Albert, and there are other towns, small towns like Alice, which are in major decline. So it's a differentiation across this typology, but even within each of these, there's different experiences that we're picking up with these different towns. And I think this map just then summarizes the settlement patterns that we're talking about. So your, you know, those that would be your city regions, the yellow ones, and then East London, etc., would be your, you know, Richards Bay, etc., maybe your more secondary cities, Bloemfontein, and so on. So we managed to map out and actually tabulate all your different settlements and categorize them in terms of this typology. And then Nelly will maybe just talk to some of the implications.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the Portfolio Committee and colleagues. I think the point that we wanted to express in this particular research work was to begin to exemplify the challenge of urbanization, but also to emphasize the view that what we do regard as being urbanized might in many ways have changed. We witnessed, for example, in localities where the densities are so high that in other countries those will be fully fledged towns and cities. And in our case, we still refer to them as rural areas. So when you speak about rural, it's not really in the real sense of what others would classify rural as. So if you go to Bushbuck Ridge, for example, you go to places in Limpopo, you look at the densities there. By just the natural growth that exists in those places, they ought to be having higher levels of services that have been granted. So in a sense, what this study is indicating to us is that we need to perhaps revisit our perception of what we call urban. The tradition has been that formally established area is what is in our mind as being urban. Secondly, we do have very rural conditions within our urban environments. And it's not fair that we continue calling those areas urban because in many ways they are not. And so the first point there on the implication is simply stating that in terms of thinking about a national agenda for an urbanization strategy, it has to be complemented by a rural strategy. So one should not only be saying about urbanization in the metropolitan sense, but urbanization in the country as a whole, taking into consideration areas that do have potential for being urban but have just not been serviced. So we have to think about them in that line. And also thinking about areas in the urban areas which are still rural. And I'm talking about our townships and far-flung areas that currently are home to the majority of the urban poor, yet they do have rural services there. So we need a much more rethinking around how we engage with those places. So I would imagine that the implication number one is really having clarity at a national level on what we are doing with those two characteristics, and therefore speaking to an urban strategy alongside with a rural strategy, and that we might be kind of faced with a challenge if we only speak of one and not the other, because the challenge exists in both. The second implication has to do with the integration approach to economic and settlement planning. And I think here the point that is being emphasized through the research is that are we clear about what implications this will have for our municipalities? And I would imagine that based on where the people are actually occupying at present, we ought to be thinking in dealing with access to basic services, but also trying to link that to areas of potential economic growth. So you would find a municipality, let's take a Matole district municipality for one. What will be the future potential of that particular district economically? And that potential might lie perhaps at a district level and even at a provincial level. So that intervention cannot be left to a Matole alone. We would need to find a way of supporting that region to ensure that the economic cake in that region is growing. At the same time, there are basic services that the region still requires at a municipal level. So some way of balancing support for growing the economic potential while still availing basic services to the citizens that reside in those areas. Topology, implication number three, I think, speaks to the issue about diversity. And if you saw one of the slides that Yusuf spoke to, the study is beginning to say that we ought to find a way of grading our settlement areas, you know, by way of typology. In other words, the suggestion there is that we may not have uniform levels of services across the country. We presently have wall-to-wall municipalities. Now, no country in the world has been able to provide uniform level of service across their nation as a whole. So we will have to accept that there is a need to have some way of categorizing levels of services. From the urban areas to the regional centers to the more flanged remote areas of the country. We remain responsible for those areas, but it's not feasible that the same levels of services can be provided there. And that is what the typology is beginning to speak about. And we do think that acknowledging that and having systems in place to be able to support and enhance the provision of those various levels based on topology might be one way of seeking to find equity across board, so you don't have certain areas not being given attention to at all. And that is what is really being raised by that. So at municipal level, the implications for us will be to say, beyond the category A, B, C municipalities, what else can we say around the levels of services across those areas? And not mainly on the basis of saying you're a metro, you're a district, or you're a region, but in a much more comprehensive way at a national intervention logic. And we do hope that perhaps this study could help us to begin to clarify some of those areas. The next one, I think, deals with being able to have a need of prioritize institutional service delivery and economic development support. Again, this is the implications that would relate to aspects that would need both national and provincial support to be able to engage at the local space. So by institutions, again, perhaps thinking about academic institutions, learning areas, how are those placed within the country as a whole, looking at some of those maps that we had and the potential that reside in those areas. How are we confronting that as a nation to try and support those areas? Economic potentials, for example, certain regions have got higher private sector interest than others. We're thinking about, again, Limpopo comes as an example, just by areas where the private sector really is demonstrating a level of interest, we as government should be leading that process as opposed to being led by the private sector, because communities are going to gravitate where there is potential. Now, if that local municipality is not preparing ahead of time to engage with those massive population influx, what are the implications for that? There are regional kind of implications by having other countries, foreign nationals, migrating into those localities. How do we prepare our local municipalities to be able to respond to those levels of trends or influx that could be caused by certain local interests that could emerge there? And then lastly, Chair, just to say that beyond legislation, we need to find a way of being able to enforce some of the existing appropriate legislation. So one of the issues that the research is pointing to is to find a way of implementing the policies that we have and the legislation that we have, identify the gaps that might be in place. Some of the critical gaps that are coming through this process is our planning legislation, for one, and I do think that the Land Use Bill and the CLARA that was mentioned yesterday are some of the areas that we will need to speed up in being able to clarify those pending legislations in a way that can help and give guidance to the local municipalities in how they engage. And we will stop there. Thank you, Chair.
The last slide was the last point, the need for concerted national action to manage environmental. You know, my preference would be to list three or four of such risks. Otherwise, it just becomes like, oh, this is their pet lobbying story again. And we don't know, so we can't relate to what you're talking about. So in future, it would be nice to do that. Even now, as we speak, just point that out for us so that we know what you're talking about. Let's proceed quickly. Brief questions, comments, and then we proceed. We will revisit this discussion, members. I think we need a deeper discussion. For example, if I may say so, Yusuf, as I was listening to here, I noticed that there was something missing here about, for example, if you use water, where is oil and energy that are key to this settlement that we are talking about? And that's where you gravitate towards the environmental risk that we are talking about. So if someone can superimpose on the map the energy requirements to support this area, that's the one observation I just wanted to make. The second one, Lesotho is stuck in between there, and there's nothing there. And but that silence is very misleading, because all of the vile work which we are pointing out there in Gauteng draws its water from there. And the question of sustainability of that comes into play, and so on. So, now, I don't know what you also get from Swaziland. and from Botswana and so on. So I'm just pointing out that the linkages between the urban and rural is a powerful message that I appreciate here. It's an improvement on the earlier versions of this perspective. And so the silence on the region and other resources that play key source is an important one. When we come back to it, let's focus on that issue. Now, I was tempted to ask for a discussion. I'm going to suggest we do the following things. I have changed. Please allow me to continue to do that, to rule from here a little dictatorially. Having spoken about the diversity of settlements and so on and so on and their management, I thought it's appropriate to request the demarcation board to do their presentations briefly, and then the local government seat. So let's proceed that way, and then we will discuss both this presentation and the demarcation. I would like us to do it that way. We'll start with this presentation and then discuss the demarcation, just so that we can manage our time differently. So, Mudula Stulo, of the board, please proceed.
Thanks, Chair. Let me just check. Am I quite audible enough in sitting from here? Yeah. Now, thanks, Chair, and members of the portfolio committee, the traditional leaders that are here, as well as the senior officials of the department and the other associated institution. I just thought that perhaps maybe I would, while the CEO is setting up, just make a brief introduction. Maybe just before I start, I would say that we have distributed the presentation as a strategic plan of the demarcation board, and we have also distributed a circular number 3, which when the presentation is being made, we would be referring to it. What I would like to say at this stage, by way of introduction, Chair, is that we are, as you know, that we are now in the, if you like, in the middle of preparation for the 2011 local government elections. That critical phase really means that we are now just about to begin to demarcate the ward boundaries, and I thought maybe perhaps I would take this opportunity to give the portfolio call committee just a heads up in terms of where the process is now. You would know that on the 15th of last month, July, the ministry did actually release the formula in terms of which the number of councillors ought to be gazetted by the MEC. We have actually now asked the MEC to do that and have given them a deadline up until the end of this month, which is the 31st of up until the 31st of July. I'm actually pleased to say that at this stage we have had about 4 provinces that have up until today been able to do that, which is the Free State, the Limpopo, and I think it's also Western Cape, and as far as I could recall, also Mpumalanga. It was quite a fairly tight deadline, but I think we thought that that has been necessitated by the fact that you would know that there was quite a fair delay on the part of the ministry to release the formula. So we thought that we should try as far as possible to make time for that. Can I then also say that what then means is that the implications of that of necessity is that we would probably in terms of our projections now still be able to have the local government elections within the constitutionally mandated time. but I think it won't, as usual, be around March. I think our projection is that, you know, with the best of intentions, it would only be able to happen possibly around May or June. We have already, you know, did convey that perspective when we met, you know, with the minister, that is, at the meeting that was convened by the ministry which involved us and the IEC. Chair, maybe perhaps, you know, with those introductory remarks, I'm going to ask the CEO of the Communication Board to kindly go through the presentation. It's quite a fair, there's a lot of slides here, but I'm sure that we will, you know, skip through them. But I think for us, as we understand, really, you know, the people is to share what we're doing, and the principal will be quite happy to answer some of the questions that are coming up for clarification. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And just to say that it does no harm for me to repeat that what we do want from the Demarcation Board, from the local government, city, and the Sierra Commission, is to flag issues that we will come back to as the year and the four other years coming to interact with you. And especially if you can point out things that are urgent, that require serious attention, so that we give those priority. It is serving as a useful induction for those of us who are new, but it must be strategic as well, so that we are able to say from the board, these are the issues that they have pointed out, they want us to follow up and so on. So don't be too deep. Breath is better. Okay, Dad.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me go straight into the presentation itself. The next two slides, Chairperson, honorable members, outline an overview of our presentation today. I'll briefly introduce the board that came into office on the 20th of February this year, then mention the six strategic themes that represent the board's priorities for the period. I will then talk about the budget and other expected income for this period, then table a number of suggested areas for policy and legislative review, which I believe this committee can we can talk about them later over time. I will not go into detail over that. Just to say that I will spend a lot more time on priority number one, because I believe it is important, then I will talk then about the rest going forward. As I mentioned earlier, Chair, the current board assumed office on the 20th of Feb. Some 20 days later, after the expiry of the term of the last board, the board, as you know by now, is led by Mr. Landia Mashangu, the chairperson. He is with his deputy, Ms. Ndumiso Gwai. Also on the board, we have Dr. Vuyom Lokoti, who is a former chairperson coming from the Eastern Cape. Kosela Mova comes from the Limpopo province. Professor Seidler comes from the Western Cape. Ms. Wendy Owens from Gauteng. Mr. Ashraf Adam from the Western Cape. Mr. Libina Sotetsi from the Free State. Ms. Linnell John from Gauteng. And Ms. Grace Castle from Mpumalanga. The chairperson, if I may add, is the only one who is full-time at the board. Now, the plan that we are presenting today was approved by the board, and as I said, it identifies six strategic themes, which, as I said, represent the board's strategic priorities for the period 2009-10 to 2012-13. Our first theme and priority is actually to facilitate accountable local government, to contribute to free and fair local government elections, and to promote democracy. And our part in this this priority is really with respect to the limitation of municipal wards in preparation for the 2011 local government elections. Our second theme, Chairperson, and priority is the redetermination and determination of municipal boundaries. And also going with that, the categorization and the categorization of municipalities. I will talk more about that later. Thirdly, is the assessment of the capacity of district and local municipalities, and whatever goes with it, the advice to MECs for local government in terms of the adjustment of powers and functions between district and local municipalities. Fourthly, we will be concerned with ensuring that we continue to have an effective and efficient organizational structure, and that an internal priority, making sure that our bureaucracy works well. Also, the issue of good governance remains important to us, and we want to ensure that those arrangements remain in place. And finally, sound financial management is something that we'll be keeping a close eye on, making sure that those arrangements remain in place. Chair, let me just talk about the first priority, where we are now busy in the process of creating those special spaces, the special environment, in preparation for the 2011 local government elections. We are doing this, Chair, in terms of the Structures Act. So it's a legal requirement which says that in preparation for every election, the board has got to undertake these exercises. Of course, there is a number of stakeholders that participate in this process, and we are really gearing ourselves to involve as wide a range of stakeholders as possible as we get into it. There's a requirement for stakeholders to act before and as well as with and after. Now, two important points that need to be made here. As I said, legislation requires that for every local government election, we need to prepare wards. And those wards must be in such a manner that the number of voters in each ward in a municipality are more or less equal. Secondly, we use the voting districts of the Independent Electoral Commission as building blocks for the wards. I think it is important for those who may not know that those are basic things that need to come up. The national minister is required by legislation, Chairperson, to publish a formula that will determine the number of councillors. The NEC for local government will then apply that formula to determine the number of wards, the number of councillors in municipalities within the various provinces. And we then use those number of councillors as the board to determine the number of wards in and then we deliver the wards, and the process goes on from there. The minister did publish on the 15th of July. There was a delay actually by the minister of some 4 months, so we did lose some time in that regard. We are now in the process where the MECs are publishing the number of councillors. As the chairperson said, to date 4 MECs have published, them having published, they would have used the information that was provided by the minister in terms of the voters' roll as on the 12th of February. And the fact that they've published means that the minister has been able to give them that information. Now, related to this process, what we need to raise at this stage is that recently the chairperson did go around the country to visit all the MECs responsible for local government. And he raised with them a number of issues and made a few requests. The first request that he made was that please publish as soon as possible. The date of the 1st July was given. As we say, 4 of them have complied. Others are still coming in that regard. We don't think it's a problem. We believe they take this matter with the necessary agency to come on board. The MECs were also requested to keep the numbers of councillors as close as possible to those in the last election, the current situation, and not to deviate too much. We have circulated circular number 3, Chairperson, which provides crucial information on the way forward, because this is going to become important to chart the way forward within this important delimitation process. What we envisage is that structures on the ground, the local population, will become a lot more involved in this process. We have had to revise our original program, Chairperson, because the original program envisaged an election date sometime in March 2011. Clearly, given the delay, that could not happen. That is why we revised that program, which then indicate at this stage that we will hand final ward boundaries to the IEC by the end of September or beginning October 2010. We had intended originally to get to hand over in August 2010. But the IEC is saying that we need them earlier, by the 1st of September. So we are applying means to make sure that we meet that date of the 1st of September. And I will talk more about that. We are adopting a staggered approach in this regard. This staggered approach means that we delimit wards as the number of councillors come in. For example, the Free State was the first to publish, and we are now busy tackling the Free State now. We will then come with the others. So the four that are with us now, we will deal with them while waiting for the other NECs to publish. The advantage of that is that the provinces that publish first will have more time for local consultations. We believe it is important to make that point, because consultations will form a very important part of this process. We have also spoken to the IEC chairperson that we will pass these boundaries on to them as we deal with the boundaries for each province, so that we don't give them the boundaries to them all in one big piece at the end. We'll be passing them on. This will give them more time to can work on issues of split cities and so on. As the chairperson said, a point has been made to the minister that a March 2011 election date is not possible. And a request has been made, a proposal really, to the minister to really declare an election date as late as possible, but clearly before the 1st of June, because otherwise then he would be out of the 90-day period that is allowed him by legislation. The following few slides, chairperson, are the time frame, the revised ones, following the publication of the formula by the minister. And it is important to take note of them. As you can see, we are now working on the first draft of wards. We are given the 31st of July for the publication of the number of councillors. We have some of them now. We are now working on the first draft of wards. This will be followed by the board then providing municipalities with these drafts for them to consult with local stakeholders. Now, this is going to happen between August to December. We would like by the 18th of December 2009 to close for the submission, and at that time also to have an idea by then as to which municipalities would like to be visited by the MDC. We will only visit those municipalities that need issues to be resolved, where, for example, they couldn't reach consensus. Consensus for the board is very important in this process, and where there's consensus, then it will go much smoother. But where there isn't, the board will then target those municipalities and go on the ground and try to sort out and drum out a consensus. The visits, chairperson, will happen from January to March 2010. And we have set the closing date of the 2nd of April for the final submissions. The final phase, the second set, let me just make a point, will then be prepared and will then start to gazette the provincial, in provincial gazettes for objections. This we are looking at the June to October 2010. By the end of October 2010, we would like to have had the limitation committees having considered all the objections, and that's where we'll be looking now at possible public hearings to deal with issues. And then by the end of October, at that time, we'll be looking at publishing the final wards and then handover, which, as I said earlier, we are targeting to do that by the 1st of September, a target which we believe can be achieved. Let me then move on, Chair, to the second priority, which is the determination and determination of municipal boundaries and categorization of municipalities. And here I need to start by saying at the beginning that for the years 2009-10 and 2010-11, which is the current year and the next year, there will be no redetermination of municipal boundaries. And the reason here is to create a stability as we're working with wards. So there will be no redeterminations for the 2 years. But there are other areas of work in which the board will continue to work. And there I mentioned quite a number of them, including the COCTA, status AIC and so on in quite a few areas, those that cannot stop. The area of work that I mentioned there, for example, is with respect to the creation of a credible set of boundaries for traditional areas. This is a project that's been led by COPTA, and if COPTA decides to proceed with it, we'll obviously be there to give support. The other one would then be the alignment of boundaries for magistrate districts and police areas to municipal boundaries. This has been done over years. It's not yet complete, and it's being led by those two departments. We'll continue to be available there. Let me move on quickly then to mention very briefly a number of significant decisions that have been taken by the board, and this happened prior to the closure of the redeterminations in 2008, and I think it is worthwhile to take note of those decisions. The first one is that Mizudin District Municipality in Gauteng has been disestablished together with its local municipalities. There were two of them in the area, and the whole area has been included into a part of it into Tshwane and a part of it into Ekurhuleni. Second significant decision has been that the Amatoro District Municipality is being reconfigured. Buffalo City has been recategorized as a metro with its current boundaries, and it will no longer be part of the Amatoro District Municipality. Thirdly, the Motheo District Municipality in the Free State has been reconfigured and will be disestablished, as Mangaung Local Municipality is recategorized into a metro and will not form part of any district municipality. That also with its current municipal boundaries. Then there are the two municipalities in the Eastern Cape of Mizana and Ndabankulu, moving from O.R. Tambo District and included into Alfred Nzo District Municipalities. There are other things that will happen there. There's the issue now of Matatiele moving back to KZN, for example. That will have an effect in that arrangement, for example. Just how, what shape that will take, I'm not sure. And also, of course, the withdrawal of the declaration of all these management areas. All the DMAs in the country, Chairperson, have been withdrawn and have been included into local municipalities. Now, all these changes will become effective at the date of the next election in 2011. Those are some of the decisions, the significant ones that I would like to mention at this stage. Let me move then quickly to task number three, which is the assessment of capacity of district and local municipalities. This we do on an annual basis, Chairperson, and we do it in terms of the Practice Act. To date, we have been doing this assessment on an annual basis since 2002. The board decided to do that to prevent ad hoc assessments. Annually, we gather data from all the municipalities, local and district. We then analyze the data, and we make recommendations to MECs. Then we produce 46 district reports, 9 provincial reports, and 1 national report. These reports have become very useful to various sectors in the country, and that's a project that remains important to us as the MDB. Now, while that continues, there are a number of issues that we would like to raise quickly with respect to the arrangement that we have now, to the annual assessment of municipal capacity going into the future. And I'd like to just lay them on the table and leave them as they are without really going too much into them. Firstly, to say that Section 85, if you look at it, of the Structures Act, says that the board must consider the capacity of municipality when it determines or determines the municipal boundary or when the MEC requested to do so. That's the MEC for local government. But we have seen over the last few years a number of developments and observations, Chair, that require us to consider other options to doing capacity assessments annually. These, as I say, are still areas of debate, and the current arrangements, I must emphasize, of annual assessments that still stands. So these are really being set out for debate. Now, the following are some of the developments. Let me go through them quickly. The first one that has come to our attention quite clearly is that MECs have not been adjusting powers and functions between local and district municipalities annually. And they have very good reasons for not doing that. The fact of the matter is that they have not been doing it. Secondly, we have observed that no MEC has ever requested the board for a full assessment of a municipality. Thirdly, this adjustment, where it has happened, the ongoing adjustments of powers and functions have been seen as having a negative impact on the stability of municipalities and civil delivery in general at local level. Also, in many instances, the MECs have actually adjusted where they did adjust at a very late stage. I'm just giving a few examples on the slide where, for example, in 2004-2005 capacity assessment period, the Northwest Province adjusted in May 2005, only 2 months before the beginning of the financial year, that's the 1st of July. The Eastern Cape adjusted in July itself. KZN adjusted 2 months after the financial year had begun. Clearly, this kind of adjustment, there's no way that it could have been taken into consideration with the IDP review and the budgeting exercise of municipalities. The result is that these IDP reviews, this municipal budgeting, allocation of staff, infrastructure, they actually have a negative impact in this regard when the adjustments are done in this way. And these are arguments that have been made in the past, Chairperson. We're just laying them on the table because we believe they need to be looked at going forward. We did come to the select committee, and these issues were made in the past. Let me move on, Chair, and not waste your time. The fourth priority really is internal, as I said earlier, and effective and efficient organizational structure, which talks really to the need for the board to always be operationally and well-organized to ensure that we have the necessary capacity and competences required for us to fulfill our mandate effectively. And our priorities in that regard are outlined in that slide, which is really to continuously build the capacity of the board's internal machinery, to improve our operational efficiencies, to seek ways really to employ and keep skilled and experienced staff, and to develop strong relationships with government and other state agencies, and citizens, data providers, and so on. Now, in our quest to have an effective and efficient administration, organizational structure, there are some internal challenges, Chair, that we are coming across. And that we are tackling really in that quest. And these are with respect, really, as we said, how we would like to structure our organization better so that we can pursue our mandate a lot more effectively. And these include, very quickly, Chair, the issue of critical skills that we need to identify, not only identify, but also make special arrangements to retain them. We are also a very flat structure due to our size, and therefore we have not been very effective in providing opportunity for individual growth of staff. We have also identified that we need to develop a profile for the board, Chairperson, and this really says we will be working out what we want the board to be known for. That's over and above the legislative mandate of boundaries and so on. We'll need to develop that profile. And also we need to increase the visibility of the board in a sustainable way. We shouldn't just come up and down as and when. We are experiencing a flood of human resources, Chair, and this relates to the earlier part of the skills, particularly GIS experts. They come in and out at a worrying rate. Inadequate and inappropriate funding remains a problem. I will show you in a slide later the issue of legislation that does not gel together. And we would like to optimize the skills of the board members there. We have a very skilled legion of board members that would like to optimize those skills, to use them optimally, but without really compromising governance principles. I'll leave it at that. I won't go into detail, just to say these are issues we are dealing with. Another priority important to us, the issue of good governance. Those are the issues. Compliance remains important for us. Admin processes and systems remain important to us. We planning execution of activities within budget. Risk management that is effective, very important. Leadership management, decision making. Unqualified audits have to be the order of the day at the MDB. It has to remain that way. And we have to have policies, Chair, that we have that work and that we review regularly over and above the internal audit function that works properly. That's priority number five. And finally, priority number six, fund financial management with those issues, really. Effective management of working capital, short and long-term manage, term budgets, well-managed after being prepared, cost control that is consistent. Those are our priorities for the period under review, Chair. Let me then move quickly, show you the budget as we have it now. For the current year, we are forecasting on the basis of budgeted expenditure a deficit of under $1,600,000. Our real worry is 2010-2011, where we have $6.5 million deficit, and this is really because of the ward limitation process. In 2011-2012, it's fine, and then as we move forward, we are not too worried. Other income that we expect, very minimal. A few areas just to touch on that we suggest for policy and legislative review. We would like to suggest a few things to enhance the stability of municipalities at local level. We'd also like a few amendments to enhance the independence and effectiveness of the board. And I'll mention them quickly. With respect to the stability of municipalities, there's the issue of that we need to table that why can't the number of ward councillors be fixed in line with, for example, with national parliament and provincial legislatures. Secondly, there's the issue of professional asymmetrical wards and professional representative councillors. We want to look at a situation where we can balance have an optimal balance between democracy and development, something that is still not the case at local level at this stage. The criteria for limitation remain very, very static, mechanical, and they don't contribute to any development of local areas. They need to be reviewed. We believe there is a way in which ward and municipal boundary changes can be synchronized. And at the moment, as I said earlier, we use VDs as building blocks for wards. And at this stage, it is the only building block. Can that be reconsidered? On the independence and effectiveness of the NDB, that's really to say, couldn't the constitution be amended to list the NDB specifically as a constitutional institution? At the moment, it's not. And also consolidated all the functions of the MDB under one act. Currently, we're working with the Demarcation Act, the Structures Act, and so on. Also the need to structure and when necessary legislate for consultation and public participation, and the role and function of full-time MDB members, in this particular case, the chairperson, not specified, something to think about. In that regard. As I said, Chair, I just went through them very quickly. If need be, they can be discussed either later or as questions come up. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable members and our guests, ladies and gentlemen, let's do the discussion. Let me not impose a structure. but suggest that if we start with the demarcation board now, because you still remember it freshly, let's do that. And then complete with the urban agenda, the Nelly and Yusuf Patel presentation. Yeah, can we do that? Who wants to start? Misile, Kosi Longonyane, Kosi Peter Smith, Councillor Johnson, yes. Please do it, make it brief, quick comments or questions, yeah.
I hope we see all supposed to listen to me very carefully because I didn't understand, so I speak clarity on that one. I just want to check.
Listen equally to those who understood and those who didn't.
So I didn't catch him clearly on how they do their demarcations that leads them towards. I just want to check whether they check the population of that area and demarcate it towards, because I've heard him saying they want to demarcate wards equally. And also checking to the previous presentation on the influx, saying that there is an influx, checking to last election that we had, provincial and national, the population in the area that I was coordinating as the election coordinator has doubled the amount of EE population compared to the other previous elections. So I'm checking, as we are talking now, we've been talking to influx to urban, and you are busy demarcating to us according to, you want to them to be equal. I just want to check how we're going to manage it. And also to check also with, are you having a working relationship or somewhere in, find yourself in some boardroom with the IEC checking, which is, since there's an urban influx, how are they going to manage? Because you've got your own target dates of doing things, you've got your own program. And now, are they having their own program, maybe to, that you're going to, the people will be registering from one, from this day to this day. Is there any working relationship with them? Thanks, Chair.
Chair, and colleagues and distinguished guests, thank you very much. Good morning. Chair, I don't know whether I must say I'm revolutionary or rather controversial. Okay. Then, first of all, I think thank you to the Demarcation Board for the wonderful presentation as usual. But first, question of, I don't know whether I heard them, I think I heard them clearly, saying that Matatiel is in fact going to KwaZulu-Natal. And when I think they know, because the minister did indicate to us, that issue will be considered through public participation in actually getting the views of the people. Now, the demarcation board, before that process actually started, is actually having that mindset that is going to KwaZulu-Natal, which, from the Eastern Cape where I come from, is a matter that we cannot leave it lying. In other words, exposing that whatever outcome to a constitutional challenge. I would like a clear comment around that issue. Where does the Martini take it that Matatiel is going to go to KZN today? The second one, I may have missed the boat here. Not their fault. Not their fault. To say Mizana and Davangulu is already part of our friend. No. I know that, in fact, Mizana, because of our factor, has been a concern that it cannot be there for exile from OR Tambo Ridge. There has been some discussion within the parties that are there. I'm shocked that it is now part of history.
and I would like him to make sure that is it history, so that I can actually report back in my constituency that they must forget or take another legal route for review. Thirdly, last, the decision not to demarcate that by August last year, not going to touch this thing. What is going to happen about many, many issues concerned by the communities around the world? Some, of course, have got an impact on traditional council, which he says they're going to deal with that for traditional council. But the concerns were pertaining to the wards within the municipal council themselves, many cases, and which actually caused some problems in us even during the campaign, because people could not vote around this issue. I say, for 2 years, forget. No, no. Where has that decision been taken, and what must we say about the views of the people around this issue, which is really a sore point? Sorry, Chair. That's all.
Chair, thanks. A couple of quick ones. The first issue, I just want clarity on the relationship between the minister's formula for the number of councillors and the determination by the MECs. Because you said, for example, the formula is completed by the minister, but now you're requesting the MECs to keep the numbers as far as possible as to what pertained in 2006. So the question, what is the scope for digression in respect of the minister's formula compared to 2006? Then secondly, I mean, we're 4 months behind schedule. Understandable, there was an election. Still, we're 4 months behind schedule, and the deadline for the completion of the exercise by the MECs is the 31st of July. Of the nine, only four have done it. And then your comment was, but it's not a problem, the others, because it will simply shorten the consultation period available to those provinces where the, you know, in other words, ones that are completed now will start now, and they'll have more consultation time than the others who will start later. I'm not sure. Tell me, what sort of pressure is being put on those MECs to comply? I'm not quite sure. One, you know, I mean, if they roll on a couple more months, there'll be no consultation time. So what kind of commitment has there been by the recalcitrant five to pull up their socks? Then, well, it's KZN, it's
Eastern Cape, it's Northern Cape, it's Northwest, it's Gauteng.
Five.
Northwest is published.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Free State was not followed by the Northwest, and then came the Western Cape, and then Limpopo.
Okay.
And
so?
Mpumalanga, but Mpumalanga not yet.
Okay. Mpumalanga has not yet published, Gauteng has not, KZN has not, Eastern Cape has not, and Northern Cape.
Yeah.
Okay, those are the what Peter Smith calls the recalcitrant ones.
Yeah, recalcitrant. Yeah, correct. They need a whip. And then, Chair, the third issue is, I mean, it's just out of interest here. You've declared a couple more metros, and they come into effect in 2011. So, but my question is that what happened? I'm not taking a position. I'm just curious as to the board's position. What happened to the request from Umsanduzi, Umshatuzi, and perhaps others also to be considered? Was it considered and turned down, or has it not yet been considered? Then I want to strongly support this notion of suspending Section 85 issue. It really causes havoc when you have the redetermination in midstream. It causes complete havoc. So if the intention is a serious one, I'm supported. And lastly, this issue of the budget, Chair, I think
before you let's be together. Just read out Section 85 quickly there.
It's the adjustment of division of functions and powers between district and local municipalities. And it's got quite a number of subsections.
The adjustment. So the problem is the timing.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah.
So the principle of adjusting is fine. But the trouble is that if there's an adjustment which kicks in after the financial year processes are in place, then it throws the municipality into havoc. I mean, you have to have an IDP, you have to have a budget. Then after that, you adjust the thousand functions. What happens? It causes havoc.
Wait a minute. What happened to the local government amendment bill?
Yeah.
I thought that's what was that. Didn't that deal with that?
No.
The local government amendment bill, no, the latest in the previous year, amended a number of pieces of legislation, including the demarcation board, that said that the such adjustment must kick in so that it falls in line with the financial years and so on. So what's the problem?
Well, there are other adjustments that are continuing to happen up until that amendment. So it is not yet.
Oh, but now you see, no, this is very important now. You see, let's hear Salga first here. Sorry? Oh, yeah, okay. Repeat what you said.
No, I was just saying that bill was saying that the need for the adjustment to become effective at the date of the beginning of the financial year.
Yes.
That really dealt with the boundary determination changes.
Yes.
Remember that. That's mm-hmm. what, here we're talking about adjustments of powers and functions as well.
Okay. Yeah. That act is no longer a bill
because
to that issue that you're raising, the adjustments of powers and functions.
Yeah, the problem there was for example where the board would determine a municipal boundary, for example, and there comes a time in certain situations where it is up to the MEC to decide on the date on which the boundary change becomes effective.
Yes.
And at that stage, Treasury was saying that. But then if the MEC decides sometime during the financial year, there are fiscal issues, the issue of equitable share and so on, which if that boundary change doesn't become effective at the date of the beginning of the financial year, or at a later date, but begin with the financial year, to give Treasury time to adjust those figures.
Mm.
I think that's what it was dealing with.
Yeah, okay. Now, what I don't understand is why isn't this being cleaned up? It appears like a political management process. That makes sense. Why do we have to use an X, a legislative X, to make people think managerially, sensibly? No, I'm also asking the department. Well, let's flag this. We'll come back to it. It's one of the issues on the agenda, and we would like to get an explanation for why it hasn't been sorted out, but it must be sorted out urgently.
Sorry, the last issue.
Yes, okay, I'll come to you.
The last issue, the budget. I mean, every election we have the same issue.
Yes.
And I don't think it's really an issue. What happens is you've got a MTEF kind of budget projections,
mm-hmm.
and if one assumes that is the figure you're going to get, then you do have a problem.
Mm.
In reality, you engage with Treasury and they up it. But the only issue is, I'd ask, is have they been engaging with Treasury for next year? What indications is Treasury giving them in respect of the anticipated 6.5
shortfall? Yeah. Honorable Tabe.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just wanted to check with the board CEO that on what stage do they engage with the key role players, like your political parties on this demarcation, your political parties, your traditional leaders. I think because when you deal with these cross-boundary issues, this boycott, they are the key role players. At what stage do they involve them? Do they involve them at the latter stage or when the process starts, they become part of the process? And the other thing is the issue of the hold on the re-demarcation of what? I don't know, but I think, like the honorable members already said, that decision, in a way, I don't think is correct. Because using the experience of the past elections of 2009, I don't think we'll be able to do that. In some of the areas, people refuse literally to go and vote in area A or B to say we don't want to belong in this area. Not the issue of the cross boundary. Just to say maybe in a ward, the ward has 12 areas. Ne? The area A is nearer to this area. But according to your demarcation, this area falls to this other area, which is too far, even in terms of the distance. And it's something that is visible to each and everybody. So if we have put this process on hold, what is going to happen to this area?
In other words, it creates the basis for instability. which is what they are trying to avoid. Okay. All right. Next question. Okay. Yeah, that's fine. So, yeah, okay. All right.
To add, Jay, Google was saying, you said in your presentation you also do your demarcation according to your VDs. But in real terms, in real experience, maybe you demarcated with a street. It's one word and it's one word. But the VD is here. It's in between the streets. I just want to check whether do you physically go there or you just demarcate Puma map and my computers on.
Councillor Kappa, Councillor Johnson here.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Good. I was wondering who is going to start today. Councillor Kappa, yesterday you kept deferring to the man yesterday. I was worried. To start first, okay.
Thank you very much. I'm equally surprised and would like to know from the board whether the municipalities themselves, their view and position insofar as demarcation process is concerned, are considered. Whether their submissions are actually taken into engagement between the district that has to release those people, as well as the municipalities themselves, in a council resolution to say we agree to be part of that district. I would want to be made very clear, because insofar as that is concerned, the district municipality of Oua Tambo refused this view together with Mbizana local municipality in a council resolution. And I do know that the traditional authorities had never been consulted until late, and they submitted to say they were not consulted in terms of Mbizana and Dabankulu. But my biggest issue is, how are you engaging or discussing or consulting the structures in the sphere of local government? And I repeat, the sphere of local government, not a tier, to be taken into consideration with their views, because they are close to the ground. They know that what might come out of a process, and then we are not many days away from Khutsong. And I would also like to know whether in these demarcation processes, SALGA is taken as an organization or just as an entity, which is established in terms of the Constitution and in terms of an Act of Parliament, the Organized Local Government Act.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I thought I'm at Oua Tambo International, where they say to you, we apologize for the delay in departure, but we will catch up time as we fly along. And the 4 months is a critical time that was mentioned. Whether the demarcation board will complete its work on time, or will it be a rush job with a lot of problems like Bushbuck Ridge, North West problems, and the new ones that came along. Also, that the issue of the disestablishment of DMA areas has got a critical impact, which means that those DMA areas and the assessments that need to be done on functional areas. Because, Chair, I can just say that there are so many cross-cutting issues pertaining to the topics that we are discussing now. The first presentation, one, indicates to us that if South Africa's in-migration into cities will mean that equitable share will increase in cities to the neglect of the rural areas. Because just on the numbers,
SAUGA has been contesting the numbers of statistics of Africa to say that we don't know how do you arrive at these. I can just quote to you in our district, 80,000 more people in Stellenbosch. We're asking, where are these people? Because we can't get a sense that it has increased unless people who are students have given, which could be one factor, but they registered as voters in somewhere else. If we look at the consultation processes also, we normally had a discussion as municipalities, not as SAUGA, individual municipalities, with the demarcation board, visits to the municipality, especially on the first phase, where the MEC in this province, in the Western Cape, did not consult with municipalities around the determination of the number of councillors, which is a critical aspect of, as far as consulting with municipalities. So, Chair, I do believe that as an institution, we as SAUGA will engage with the demarcation board to draw the attention, what are the consequential issues of particular demarcation and actions pertaining. Powers and functions is another area that we normally have a proper consultation process with the demarcation. My appeal is, let's try to do new things, a new style, a new way of doing things in consulting with municipalities, so that we don't land up in a situation where municipal governance comes to a halt, like in Khutsong, and over a protracted period where it was very difficult to manage that municipality.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to add a voice to comments or questions raised by other members. I've got two issues. The one is a general concern by traditional leaders throughout the country. It is the question of which is related to the delimitation of what which divide the area of an inkosi into many municipalities. This is a concern, and you find that traditional leaders are not consulted when all this is done. The second issue is the issue which was raised at at page number 20. That one of Mutswedi District Municipality and its areas, its other municipalities, which is being incorporated into Ekurhuleni and Tshwane. I know the residents of one of the areas, and that is Bronkhorstspruit. They were never consulted about this issue. So how did the demarcation board arrive to this? I think we are inviting problems ourselves here, Chairperson. Thank you.
Chair, just on the assessment reports of the board, I think it's excellent work that they are doing year after year. And they now come to us and say, but the MECs don't act on that. And there's all sorts of problems with time concerns and budgets and IDPs and so on. And therefore, we have to have a relook at Section 85. But isn't there the other way that... So actually what we're saying, we've got this excellent reports, we've got this excellent recommendations, but they don't act on it. And if they act not timelessly, so let's scrap the actions that should follow, which for me, to me is the wrong route. I think when we meet again, we can, of course, as you've indicated, Chair, we must discuss this again. But I just want to point out that I think that the reports that this board produces are excellent, and we should rather look at how they can be implemented to assist local government than just to walk away from them. Thank you very much.
Chairperson and CEO, do you want to respond?
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I think there's quite a fair number of questions that were raised. What I think I will attempt to do will be to deal with those that I can, and the CEO, and I guess also my deputy chair would actually also add. Let me maybe start with the questions that have been raised, and maybe some of them seems to be the question of clarity. Chairperson, if you can really indulge me, I'd like to deal with the possible misunderstanding or the impression that we may have created, or the CEO may have, created around Matadiel. I think that's a that's a question that was raised by Unkosi Nokonyan. The fact of the matter is that what we are saying is that we're not preempting any decision. I think what was meant to be said there was that Alfred Nzo, as it's been currently demarcated by the Demarcation Board, has got one portion that is a subject of, the Constitutional Court process. What we're saying is that we don't know what the outcome is. I think maybe the CEO might have seemed to have indicated to say the outcome might either, remain as it is, or it might go somewhere. But what we're saying is that it is something that as a Demarcation Board that, we need to take into account, is that clearly the outcome of the Constitutional Court, process in Matadiel would definitely mean, whether we like it or not, some kind of a review of the current, boundaries. So we know that it is an issue that is outside our remit in terms of our responsibilities, but I think we need to take into account how does it affect the board. Is that clearly the way Alfred Nzo has been currently, at least in terms of the recent redetermination, is that Matadiel is part of that. Now, if for instance, for some reason, there is an outcome that seems to be saying, look, maybe this thing had to be different, obviously after all the due process that has been done, it means that district as it is will be, if you like, technically a cross-boundary district, which cannot happen. So what we are saying is that we are currently relooking at those, redetermination. We cannot ignore, that process, coming up. So if we create an impression that we seem to be, preempting one decision, I think we need to, profusely apologize. That was not the intention. We are not.
Chairperson.
Yeah.
No, let me come to your rescue. It's not even your business to do so.
Absolutely.
So it is not the business of the Demarcation Board to decide where a municipality falls in. That's a political process. It's not a decision of the Demarcation Board. Where the municipality resides, in terms of the provinces, the board has nothing to do with that. This is an important fact, legal position we must understand, please. Even if they might have a bias one way or another, even if they might have a view of one view of one kind or another. And what the CEO said was that if that happens, we may have to do that. So I think it was the passions. These things produce passions where we are located. Because Don Kwanyana comes from there. It's his constituency. He has a perspective, and that's important. We are able to deal with the subjective and the objective views that we hear here. Remember we said you've got a view, and there's the truth. So we must navigate that sensibly. Don't feel under attack, Chairperson. This is what happens in these discussions. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. But I thought I must,
clarify. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. The other issue that has been raised, I think it's around, I think it was raised by MP, is it Nondumiso, around the issue of the influx of people, and I think she seems to be saying that, how do you take into account a person that has just, taken place on the urbanization. I think What we should clarify again is that the way ward delimitations are being done are really based on a number of registered voters. Now, we know for a fact that in large part, the number of registered voters is indeed driven by migration and possibly a natural growth of population. But, you know, this is basically what normally forms, you know, the basis upon which, you know, the number of councillors are determined. It's not directly really out of the population figure. So what then we, you know, we're saying is that we're not using really population directly as it is. We really use the number of registered voters. Now, the idea that we need to have, the principle really is that you would like a situation where each and every ward has, in other words, each and every councillor or councillors, put it that way in the ward, because there's always two, have got almost similarly the same number of people, registered voters, as in other ward. That's the principle of the formula. The one of the, I think, issues that was raised, I think that is related, is by Honourable Smith about the relationship between the formula that the minister determines as well as the number of councillors, you know, by the MEC. Basically, the ministry does issue a formula, which is basically has got to be applied by the MECs to use to determine the number of councillors. Now, the way it works is that basically the MEC have got a space to differ from the formula, you know, by 15%, you know, upward or downward. So it's basically saying you know, serve as a basis.
Deal with Peter's question this way. Has any MEC ever gravitated towards the 15% up or downward in any province? Has it ever happened?
Well,
that would be useful to know, because you see the impression may have been created that if the minister sets up this formula, you don't even get the hell out of it. So they just follow the line mechanically, and you are saying that's not true.
No, it has happened, you know, before.
Yeah.
It has happened. And I think even in this case, we suspect it will happen in some cases. Now, what normally accounts for the differences, you'll see that, is that even if, although the CEO did indicate that I've met each and every MEC, those that were responsible for, those that are responsible for the, you know, for the local government. And indeed, you know, my plea to them was to say, as far as possible, stay close to the numbers or the number of, you know, councillors that were there last day. But in most cases, it is almost inevitable, because what then happens is that even if you keep the formula as it is, you don't change anything. Because the formula, you know, the mess of the formula, the way it's been driven, is the number of registered voters. You'd have an increase. Even if you don't do anything. Now, hence, if you still want to keep the numbers, you need to go, you know, on the 15% downward. So so you would find that in some cases there would be changes, and I know in most of the district, I mean, it seems to be, you know, showing up in some of the provinces rather. So that is the situation. Now, clearly, I think from my side, I would not really characterize all the MECs that are still really struggling as recalcitrant, but I think you know, they're trying their best. I think in most cases, some of them have technically almost, you know, completed you know, their work. I think it's a question of really trying to, you know, check whether these things are actually correct. I know, I mean, KZN, for instance, was really as far back as about, I think, last week or so, as far as I know. They know that there has been a change in terms of the MEC, and clearly the officials did tell us that I think they need to appraise, you know, the new MECs. So my view is that we would still be able to, you know, to get all this, the number of councillors in time to be able to do that. fact, why we have actually altered for a much more staggered in our approach was precisely to say, look, I mean, we must find a way within the process to see whether how we could, you know, make up, you know, for the time loss. It is true. I think 4 months is quite a period to actually lose, you know, in terms, you know, of this process. I think in terms of then the I think the issue that was also raised and I'm kind of jumping around here. Yes, I think the issue of the budget, really, we are engaging National Treasury, and I must say, you know, being new into the process, I think it is something that has always, you know, puzzled me why it was very difficult for the National Treasury not to actually understand that this is exactly where we would need to have, you know, appropriate, you know, resources to be able to take that process. But I think it is something that we know that we will be able to persuade them, you know, to reconsider some of the funds that they've allocated to the board. The issue that I thought maybe I should touch on before maybe I give it to the CEO to deal with some of the question, I think, is the issue that was the issue that seems to be saying, I think it's partly maybe part of the misunderstanding, why it becomes necessary for us at a particular point to stop the further redetermination of the outside world boundaries in natural gas. And it's purely a practical matter. Basically, what we are saying is that you should reach a stage whereby you basically freeze the outer boundaries of the municipalities to allow, you know, for us to be able to redemarcate the inner boundaries, which is the world boundaries. Otherwise, you would have a situation whereby if you do not have that, I think the situation may not be you know, work really in the manner that it should. You need at some stage to say, this is the boundaries of these municipalities now, we're not changing anything up until we've finished the ward boundaries. So it is purely a practical matter. And I think is that we have technically also opened, you know, that process at some stage. I know, for instance, in Marafong we had to redo it when we've already, you know, you know, closed. But it is just purely to allow us, you know, to work with entities that that are really, you know, stable. So it's freezing outer boundaries, not so much in terms of the inner world boundaries.
That experience in our politics, you can't continue to nominate when the list process is over. Sorry, Chair. Now that you are a bit far, Chairperson Matang.
Yes.
Sorry, now that you are far, could you please take care of the Gabangulum Bizana issue and the Umgunguzlovu issue as well that have been raised before I deal with the others?
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, I was going to deal with them. The the issue of Umsunduzi, let them start with. We have had a discussion with the MEC Mkuno on this matter. We have been informed of some of the issues that they have around Umsunduzi as it is. We've already said that the board has taken a decision that it should be a metro or, you know, on its current boundaries. One thing that we had clarified was that maybe contrary to the perception that may be around, the board has never said this issue, if you like, it is closed. Clearly, if there are, you know, representation, you know, from their side, that seems to be suggesting any other reconfiguration other than that the board that have done, the board would look at those. And that's the message that we have left with them. It is true that time is also quite important. I mean, let me say, for example, is should we get a representation from Umsunduzi to reconsider, you know, the boundaries there, you know, or have a different, you know, reconfiguration that they want to suggest. You know, we'll have to look as to whether is it something that we should do still in this cycle, or should wait up until, you know, the next, you know, elections. We would prefer, like as I've already indicated before, not to tamper with the outside boundaries now, unless otherwise really, you know, it has become, put it that way, extremely, you know, necessary to do so. But as far as I know, except that for some discussions that have taken place outside in terms of the framework of our consultation, we have not as yet have had a formal, you know, response, you know, from, you know, from Pietermaritzburg that actually seems to suggest that, you know, the board should, you know, reconsider the decision as it stands. Like I said, I've met with the MEC and I said, look, MEC, this is completely in your hands. Should you actually, you know, require for us to reconsider the matter, formalize it to the board, and I will look at that. Now, the issue of Mizan, I think, is a similar situation, and as far as I know, there has been consultations, you know, in the board. I mean, in terms of the legislation, you know, of the board, in terms of that regeneration. Now, the Bizana Ntabankulu and you know, Alfred Nzo issue is, it is something that you can't separate it from the Matatiel one, because you must remember that the effect of our determination basically is now intricately linked to the, you know, to the Matatiel issue. We would obviously be, as a board, having a special board meeting to look at those determination that we've made, where there is the, you know, the constitutional court processes, of which the Alfred Nzo and Matatiela is one. So you know, that's an angle that we would actually take. And up until such time, the outcome of the constitutional court, whatever direction it actually comes, would have to reconsider, you know, those redeterminations. But as we stand now, and unless otherwise being changed by that process, the Alfred Nzo, you know, district is composed of the municipalities that have been, you know, recently determined. But like I said, is, you know, we'll have, I mean, there are processes that would actually, will have to await, you know, for us to actually reconsider that decision. So So that is the status, you know, in terms of that. Now, Khosi Kotama raised an issue around the involvement of traditional leaders, as well as also raised on the same breath the issue of Mutsweding. We have, and I've already offered to Khosi Kotama that we'll be quite glad to address, you know, the House or, for instance, this committee of the chairperson. Essentially, the legislation does require us to take care of the traditional authority council, you know, boundaries when we make wards. But like any other issue, you know, traditional authorities or traditional boundaries normally defies, you know, the formal boundaries. While we are trying as far as possible to ensure that we, ensure that the, you know, the communities that have got allegiance to one Hoshi are in the same ward, but it's not always possible. It is something that we are, you know, we know that is actually common. In fact, on the three MECs that I've seen, they've raised, you know, that issue. But we've always said, you know, traditional authorities, you know, defy some of the formal boundaries. In fact, I'm being told that some of the traditional, you know, authorities actually defy, you know, the country borders. So it is something that, you know, there's a Hoshi that have got, you know, allegiance in Swaziland. So, you know, it's not always possible to accommodate, you know, every community in one ward. The issue of Mutsweding, indeed, it was raised by the MEC for Gauteng. It's a very complicated matter because at the time when the board made that determination, there was an overwhelming, you know, support, you know, for that. The MEC does concede when he spoke to me to say the people now that are there are different, you know, the priorities have changed. But this is something that, Chair, you have already said, you know, it's really beyond the board. I think it is really a political matter which I think, you know, must be sorted, you know, at that level. If clearly there is a different movement, or put it this way, you know, opinions that have actually changed, you know, once again, it must be something that is channeled at an appropriate level. But like I say, is that the board would always determine and redetermine, you know, boundaries based in terms of whether it fits, you know, with the criteria. So I can say that, look, you know, up until such time we get some sense what Gauteng wants to deal with this. If it feels that this matter is actually urgent in such a matter, it can't wait up until the next elections. I think they'll have to really contact the board and convince us as such. But at that point, when the board made that determination, there was an overwhelming support for that decision. I may have skipped other issues, but let me maybe deal with the one that was raised between the relationship between the board and actually SALGAM. This is something that somewhat the CEO did allude to. Clearly, we are really in the process of trying to strengthen the relationships that we had with key stakeholders, of which SALGA is a very important one. Clearly for us, yes, indeed, we do believe that I think SALGA ought not to communicate with the board clearly through circulars, and there's a process that I know that the CEO of the board and the CEO of SALGA are putting in place to have a relationship that is structured at a much more cordial level. So this is something that we'll have to work on, and I think there's also a consideration to see whether how could we ensure that SALGA gets much more involved in terms of our in terms of some of our subcommittees. Chairperson, let me take breath then and allow the CEO to continue, and I will also maybe come back if there are issues that I may have left out.
No, thank you, Chair. I'm actually the chairperson has dealt with the bulk of the issues that were raised, so I'll just deal with some of the minor ones that he did not touch. The issue of the working relationship with the IEC, yes, we do work quite closely with the IEC. In fact, these timelines have been discussed with them. That is why how the issue of the 1st of September came up. We are aware of their timelines or what they intend to do, and we work very closely. We also have a technical level that involves the IEC as well as COPTA, represented in what we call local election task. The technical committee that meets on a regular basis to deal with these kind of things on the ground. So a very close relationship dealing with that. The notation according to VD is whether we physically go there. But over and above that, what is important to note is that is why we also make it a very localized process. As I said in the beginning, the structures on the ground have got to come together and come up with proposals. If there is no consensus, we also go there. And then we are also on the ground as well, looking at the issues that are taking place. And later on, there is the space as well for public hearing. Also another opportunity to be out there. So there's a lot of input and opportunity to really take into account what is on the ground in that regard. So let me... yes. At what stage do we engage political parties and key stakeholders? As I explained earlier, ma'am, once the first draft goes out, that is the time when all the stakeholders get engaged as well. We will have other drives as well, in which we publicize these events as a result of that, but key stakeholders, we have made out a memo in which we address to CDWs to say get involved because we want this to be on the ground as much as possible. I think I'll stop there. The chair has already dealt with it.
Very sorry, but we are not reopening this thing. We are proceeding to the next presentation. Local government seeker, I'm afraid we can't do that. We will have an opportunity to get involved in depth with these issues. They are critical. Strategically, the most important message are the time frames that are left, the consultations that must take place, which are provided for. Now we know we must go and communicate them so that we facilitate inputs into those processes in the time frames that we have. It is also in the documents that we have before us, but properly as a committee, we will call the demarcation board to come and engage in depth with those issues. For that reason, we will proceed. I know that people feel very strongly about these issues. We can't even go back to the earlier discussions that I promised we would question, the first presentation, because of your passion for demarcation.
it raises people's temperatures, high blood pressure, and so on. So we don't have enough support to deal with explosions of that nature in this room. Now, local government, Situel Mufuge, please give us some ease of environment. Let's hear how your presentation will deal with us. Please proceed that. I think in the responses that we received, the linkages between this process and the earlier presentations were very clear. And so, as we said, I guess that's the basis for the interaction of these entities that report to the COCTA, the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Leaders. Councillor Johnson, you suggested yesterday that if the name started with Traditional Affairs, we would have an interesting acronym. I still want to hear, just out of my curiosity, what it would be. But don't say it now, hopefully you'll tell me at lunchtime. yeah, okay. Are you ready, Dad?
We're ready, sir.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Firstly, I would like to apologize that the chairperson, Mr. Keith Kusel, had to go back to Durban. So he said we must extend his apology. Chair, we have difficulty in the presentation because we are asked to come and say something to new members. So if you find the presentation lacking, please excuse me. But what we attempted to do, Chair, was to, given that there are new members, to give a brief outline about, you know, where CETAs come from, because everybody has got a different conception of what the mandate of the CETAs are, or what the CETAs are established for. And that's how I would like to approach the presentation, just give a brief history about CETAs, the CETA in the skills development labyrinth, the maze of complicated stuff, that maze explained, the purposes, processes, the structures of the CETA, the strengths and weaknesses, and the way forward. I won't delve into the history, Chair. You would know that we, in the 80s, we had a national strength.
To say that even with your preamble, focus on the strategic, practical issues.
Okay.
That will be very helpful. The other stuff will come back to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chair, I'm not going to get there. I'm going to skip then the complicated other stuff. Safe to say, Chair, that as a CETA, we operate within two strategic frameworks, the one being the strategic framework of the Department of Labor in terms of the National Skills Development Strategy. We have to respond to our sector priorities in terms of the mandate as spelled out in the Skills Development Act. We do have another mandate in terms of the South African Qualifications Authorities Act of prioritizing qualifications and standards in the sector and accrediting providers to provide education and training and do the quality assurance. However, because we work within local government, Chair, we also have to take cognizance of the local government strategic priorities being the sector that we service. I'm just trying to skip through the slide. It was a very loaded slide. Let me get to the slide. Because we work, and you've seen this slide before, because we work within local government, we have to take cognizance of what are the key strategic drivers within the sector, and largely that is legislation. And we spoke yesterday at length about the problems that we normally experience about the myriad of legislation that seems to be an impediment to local government service delivery. I'm not going to go into details about that. What we do in identifying the needs at a sector level, we go through a rigorous method of of conducting research called sector skills planning, and it reflects at the national level mainly the data that we get from municipalities or the data that we gather independently through a sector skills planning process, and of course in collaboration with other research that is undertaken in this sector by the demarcation board and other partners we work with. And we cascade that right down to a regional level and at the workplace level, where we get data from the municipal-owned planning, and there are also inherent weaknesses in the planning within those. We try to make sense of that data, and based on that research, we develop an empirical analysis of what our intervention should be. And part of that is developing scarce and critical scarce skills, a list thereof, which we circulate to municipalities on an annual basis, and also determining an organizing framework for occupations, what we call OFO. What we find is a key challenge in the sector, just in summary, is absence of norms and standards in service delivery, absence of norms and standards in staffing and competency requirements, lack of capacity in planning, lack of institutional capacity, development planning, land use, special, urban and regional planning. Other challenges, Chair, is the question that we spoke at length about yesterday, compliance with legislation, and you spoke about rightfully the question of malicious compliance. The question is not about whether compliance is required, but the question is whether before we introduce new legislation, do we quantify the cost of implementing that legislation, which presents a problem to municipalities. And I've just given an example there around the particular prescripts of the MFMA in particular, and Councillor Johnson did indicate yesterday the particular typology of problems presented by one piece of legislation, being MFMA. Your supply chain requirements, before you can procure a good or a service, there's a lead period of 120 days before you actually get to awarding the tender, and there are complications. I mean, it's just one typical example. You can take all other pieces of legislation, you can see the complexities. So the issue here is not whether we need compliance or whether we need to have regulation. We do, however, it's the capacity to implement that presents a problem. What we then do, Chair, out of our planning, we have identified six key priority areas emanating from our research, which are areas where, as a CETA, we are really focusing all our intervention in terms of developing scarce and critical skills, and also investing our discretionary funding in terms of implementing those programs, and directing municipalities to focus more in their planning, in planning around those areas that we've identified. And those are the five areas, Chair, that we have presented before this House previously. You will see that we've added one other aspect. It's called workplace training systems. Basically what that means, Chair, we are looking at supporting workplaces that previously within the sector were providing training, like an example is the old Premos, Pretoria Municipality Operating Centre, the old, it's now Tshwane Academy of Leadership, to become a Institute of Sectoral Occupational Excellence. What that is, Chair, and it's ISOE, I know you don't like acronyms, is to build the capacity of local government training for local government to train for itself. We believe that the expertise lies within local government to teach local government about local government problems. We believe that other institutions of learning could complement what can be provided at the local government level, but the core of that training must come within local government. So what we would naturally then do is to assist that workplace training provider or the employer to build the systems required to be able to implement training in the workplace for themselves and for other local authorities within their their area or their jurisdiction. A typology of programs that would then be implementing in that workplace is a range of them as listed in that list, the 1 to 5 above. We do work collaboratively with other stakeholders, and I didn't want to enter the fray of yesterday's debate whether COPTA needs to get directly involved in providing training or whether it needs to establish an academy or so. But what I can say maybe to that chair is that we believe that it is correct that the department should set standards or should influence the process of standard determination for training in the sector, but it needs to do that as a way of ensuring relevance of provision of training around certain areas where they have interest. But it should allow practitioners and subject matter experts, both from the training sector and within industry, to facilitate that training, and they would then determine whether it is appropriate, relevant, or adequate. And therefore, the department could rightfully so have to play that role of influencing standards, of ensuring that standards are properly coordinated and monitoring. And our role as a quality assurer in terms of qualifications authority, ETQA for our sector, would be to support the department to do that. May I also say, Chair, that the current Logola within the department has been accredited by us. The qualifications on management and leadership that was registered with SAQA was facilitated by us with the input of the department and with the Palama also making input in that. And they have to now look at appropriate providers to facilitate that program on their behalf. So as a way of just responding to yesterday's input, I thought I could use today to highlight that. The same prevails, Chair, for other professions. It is the professional bodies, like in accounting or in engineering, that influence the standards in accounting. That's why we have generally accepted accounting practice or generally recognized accounting practice. Those standards are set by the profession or the industry in engineering, and they ensure that whosoever facilitates that training offers the training to the standard. And you've had also issues around certain higher academic institutions being deaccredited by SAICA to offer CA programs because they were not up to standard. So I'm saying we have practice that we can learn from. Just to move the chair to the question of collaboration with key role players. Those are the key role players we work with. You will see that we work both with the department on a range of programs within the identified focus areas. We also work with professional bodies in the sector and outside of the sector, with SAICA on the standards on accounting, with our sister CETA, FACET, Finance and Accounting CETA. We also work with civil engineers. We work with the South African Council of Planners. We work with the Property Valuers Council. We work with the Institute of Municipal Finance Officers. We work also with other higher education and training institutions that we've identified as Institute of Sectoral Occupational Excellence in particular fields, and those, some of which are identified through other stakeholders. A point in case is like the University of the Western Cape and the University of Pretoria, who are facilitating programs for us, for counselors, on creative leadership and management. Those are our ISOEs for providing those programs, but the qualifications and the standards have been developed or facilitated by us. Chair, I've got two or three last slides. We are a 140 million rand CETA, contrary to belief that we have a lot of money, we don't. We receive a levy income of approximately 140 million from the sector, and the sector includes SALGA, 283 municipalities, municipal entities, the bargaining council, and any other entity that may be linked to local government. the bulk of the levy, you'll see 32%, which is 41 million, comes from municipalities in Gauteng, followed by the Western Cape, and the next one is KwaZulu-Natal. The Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal is 18% of the levy. And the rest are trailing behind between 10 and 4%. And utilities or entities is 1%. And largely in that 1%, it's the entities that belong to the city of Joburg. In terms of grants that we've dispersed back to the sector, that amount of 128 million includes also prior year allocations. Ordinarily, we disperse back to the sector 50% of the levy that they pay to us. So out of the 136 million, we would have dispersed half of that. However, in the year that ended March 2009, we dispersed 128 million. That would include prior year adjustments. And these are problems. The prior adjustments come as a result of SARS misallocations, or it comes as a result of Dole, Department of Labor, having paid the levy in another levy year. Yeah, we have to reinvest in municipalities. These mandatory grants, Chair, we disperse them against an approved training report that municipalities submit to us. At the beginning of the training year, they would give us a plan as to how many people they're going to train, in what occupational categories, based on the framework of scarce and critical skills we provided. We would evaluate that and we would then disperse back to municipalities. That's the quantum of money that we can attest to, that it has gone to training. Attest to as in paper chain. The truth is, a substantial portion of that amount doesn't go back to training, or it's never invested in training. It is invested in other areas to assist municipalities balance their books. So there is Chinese, or let me not say, creative bookkeeping that happens in municipalities. What we are doing in that respect here, we've put in place already a monitoring mechanism to ensure that the money that we reinvest or we disperse back into municipality indeed goes towards training. It begs the question, because I know one member might ask a question to say, if you say 128 million of mandatory grants were dispersed back to municipalities, why is it that we're having problem of skills and so forth and so forth? So that tells you already that there's a problem. The money is not there. We know that. We have limitations in terms of the act as to what we can do and we cannot do. The money that we disperse back to municipalities, if municipalities redirect it, and this happens across all municipalities without exception, many of the municipalities, embarrassingly so, even some of our big municipalities, that money gets redirected, money meant for training gets redirected to other things. So our limitation is that in terms of the act, we cannot do anything once the money is in the hands of the employer. We are not able to compel the municipality to utilize that money for training. We try, in terms of the disclosures, to compel them to give us evidence on a quarterly, on a monthly. We have a monthly monitoring system to give us documentary evidence as to the training that has been undertaken in terms of receipts and invoices and the list of learners and the training providers involved. You know, it's a difficult one. But if the municipality were to tell us to go fly a kite, we have no legal recourse at all. So that's one challenge that we need to look at it. We bring it to your attention, however, it's a matter that the Portfolio Committee on Labor has to deal with. And this is not only peculiar to local government, but it happens in other sectors. Now that the CITAS are moving to a new executive authority, of course, it's the new executive authority, being the Minister of Higher Education now, who must deal with that issue. In terms of the discretionary grants, Chair, that we provide, that we've allocated in the year under review, in this area we have much control, because these are funds that are made available to employers for certain specific strategic sector priorities. These are given at our discretion, and these we allocate conditionally. We sign an agreement with all these parties, and therefore we can hold them to performance in terms of agreement and complying with the conditions of the funding agreement. And these are areas where we're spending money in all those areas. You will see that in other areas there hasn't been movement with the money that we allocated to the Department of Water Affairs. I don't know whether it's still DWAF, but I know it's Water Affairs. Yeah, it's DWAI. Okay, they used to be DWAF when we gave them that money. We've further allocated an additional 30 million in that project, and this is around really training municipal employees on the maintenance of the water and wastewater treatment works. We have an entire research that we've done on each waste treatment plant in the country, the status thereof. Some of the problems are not problems of skills and training. Some of the problems are problems that came about due to poor planning on the part of the municipalities or uncoordinated planning. We can give you an example. Where I come from in Ekurhuleni, we have 9 wastewater treatment works. Of the 11 wastewater treatment works, 7 of those are operating above design capacity and the flow capacity because of the urban conurbation. And the municipality, in its response to provide housing, did not take cognizance of the load that the development would put on the infrastructure. And I'm just talking about wastewater treatment plants, but it also relates to other networks, infrastructure networks. We've also spent an amount of 21 million with respect to training for the unemployed. A portion thereof is the training of community development workers in the Eastern Cape, the last cohort that we trained. And that amount also includes not the cost of training, but also the cost of stipends that we provide. And we are proud that of all the CDW that we've trained, all of them have been absorbed by the province, and they are deployed in municipal wards. And we also happy that other government entities and government departments are making full use of the CDWs. In that program also, Chair, there's a component of training of counselors in various programs that we normally list them under unemployed. The question of full-time, particularly non-full-time counselors. Mr. Stolle, the CEO of NHCL, did indicate that we have a gentleman's agreement. There is no gentleman's agreement, Chair. There is an agreement. We are reviewing our MOU with NHCL and other structures, and we have had a very interesting review workshop with DPLG. Because part of what we think we need to do as a support agency is to respond to COPTA and SALGA, and government generally identified priorities by ensuring that there are development of standards and qualifications, that there is funding provided in priority training areas, that we utilize our discretionary grants of funds in priority areas, and we improve the knowledge base of workplace employment profiles, and we ensure participation in what is our core business, implementing the National Skills Development Strategy. So that's all, Chair. Thank you.
Let's take quick questions. Peter? Some very quick questions. Tell me, I saw the Abbott training was for employees. Do you not think there's also a need for counsellors? There are many counsellors who are literate. Why isn't it extended to them as well? Secondly, on this creative bookkeeping exercise, I wanted to ask, this redirection of that funding towards subsidising other expenditure by the municipalities, is it actually legal? Are they complying with the law? And if it's not legal, what does the Auditor General have to say about it? You may not have the power to intervene, to force compliance, but does anybody else? I would be quite surprised if the legal position is that it's permissible. Then, also related to that, how much of that discretionary, I mean, of the other discretionary sum returned, the non-discretionary, of that amount returned to the municipalities, how much in your, not that particular financial year, 128, because it applies to previous years as well, but in percentage terms, how much actually gets spent on training? How much gets redirected? Thanks.
Of the, what's the compliance rate? Submission of workplace skills plans, and then how many actually do claim? Now, you see what happens, they're supposed to submit this, that this is what we're going to do and so on. But then they have to produce it properly so that they can then get money to be able to implement it now. How many of them, having done so, do actually claim back? Okay. So it's the compliance rate of submitting and then claiming the money. You've introduced the third factor that those who do claim it use it for, let's be generous and say it is used for clearing up the billing systems, which is problematic. Okay. Sorry? No, that's Peter's opinion. Don't fight.
Chair, just quickly, the 70% are disbursed as grants and 10% kept for administration. The other 20%?
I'll take the question from Honorable Thurman. Janet will do the other questions. The funding model is such that we get 1% of payroll paid to SARS in terms of the slide I didn't show, the first line. And yesterday, interestingly, we were calculating figures given the wage agreement. There's one dimension, Chair, of disclosure. In terms of completeness of revenue. When we calculated the figures that Saga mooted, they said as the wage being 440 billion, we then calculated what should have been 1% of payroll coming to the CETA, and it falls far short of what we are receiving. Give or take here, and it's not even within the margin of error that we've provided for. So what that means, it means we have to go back to Salga and verify that we are being shortchanged by municipalities. But also 1%, it constitutes 100% that must come to us. 20% goes to the National Skills Fund, and to the National Revenue Fund, and we can access it if there are strategic projects. For instance, when we started with the training of the CDW, in the initial project, we spent 11 million and the NSF spent 71 million. And in the subsequent years, we had to fund the entire program because we had adequate funds in our own discretionary funds. So the 20% goes there. 10% goes towards our administration, and 20% goes into our discretionary grant reserve. So that's the money we utilize to dish out as Father Christmas to all these people who respond to the sector priorities.
Just in terms of responding to the first question, which was on the need for ABET for councillors, councillors are certainly not excluded from participating in the ABET program. However, relatively few municipalities apply for discretionary grants for councillor ABET training. They get. Then, secondly, in terms of submission rates of workplace skills plans, we've had a steadily increasing number of municipalities actually submitting their workplace skills plans. In terms of the 30th of June submissions this year, we've got a 96% submission rate. So we've got very few municipalities which are not complying. Our most significant provincial improvement in submission came from KZN, where we in fact have 59 municipalities which have submitted this year, which is the first time we've ever. Out of the 61 or 62. Yeah. So that's a huge improvement. In terms, well, we're currently busy evaluating the workplace skills plan, so I can't tell you on the basis of this year how many people will actually receive grants. But last year we had a 94% submission rate, and it was 83% that actually received grants back from us. So they either had not submitted workplace skills plans, what they'd submitted could have been incomplete, or, and that was a key thing that actually factored in there, was the incompleteness of submissions. They may have submitted late, because if they submit after the deadline, whilst they can appeal that, if they do submit late, most of them don't bother to appeal it. They just let it go. So that's what the figures look like for last year. In terms of the actual amount that of the grant that gets spent on training, again, because we currently are just finishing off our evaluations right now, we're completing the Eastern Cape, which is our last province this week. Difficult to say on the basis of last year, but in terms of previous years, it's approximately 60% that gets spent on training. I'm not talking about the quality of the training, but that gets spent on the training, and about 40% goes into, I don't know, but it does not get used for training.
And is that legal?
No. And what does the Auditor General do about it? Nothing much.
He told that there's a gross negligence, not negligence, violation of the law. That's what the last broad report says.
He's not being for
Well, I mean, I would imagine when he says that, he speaks about a number of, for example, if you receive money, you're supposed to spend it on this. You didn't do it, that's illegal. That's what he's referring to, amongst other things. I don't know what else he does. Yes, ma'am.
Chairperson, I just wanted to ask maybe the sitter to send maybe to the portfolio committee, maybe to speak to the secretary Sharon, a breakdown list of maybe all the municipalities that they've registered or applied for this grant, so that we could be able to encourage our own municipalities and our own constituencies to do so, to use this opportunity.
Yes. Okay. Okay, go ahead, ma'am.
Sorry, just one further observation coming out of this year's evaluation of the workplace skills plans is that the majority of municipalities appear to be using their mandatory grant, which is supposedly primarily to train their own employees for the training of unemployed people within those municipal areas. And that, of course, does not necessarily translate into improving the municipality's service delivery capacity.
Linked to that, Chair, we make discretionary grants available on specific conditions. We say to a municipality, if we give you discretionary grants to train the unemployed, there has to be an intention to employ them in the scarce and critical scarce skills areas. So for which we are prepared to fund the cost of training, to fund the stipend during training, and also to provide a retention grant for 6 months to retain that learner in the workplace to get experience. And we find that municipalities are not applying for those grants, largely in those areas, but they would rather utilize their mandatory grants for maybe a similar purpose, but one can assume what the reasons are. They're more political than others. In one or two municipalities we've established, which is a bit problematic because we then get a rebuff from Labour saying that there's no training happening, money is utilized, it's redirected. Whereas there is funds available for the CETA for the same objective and for the same purpose, but the bottom line should be we don't want to invest money for training of the unemployed if they'll remain unemployed after training. And if they're trained in areas where there are no prospects for employment, either within municipalities or ancillary or related industries to municipalities or self-employment opportunities.
On the 1%, is it on total cost to the municipality or is the perks excluded? You know, this is a big thing that we must perhaps just deal with, or I mean, I think we as a committee will also like to.
I think there are some sweeping statements being made that's not validated by any, proof in terms of the developmental role of local government.
Like what?
Like, for instance, it does not, by using some of the funds to the benefit of unemployed people, it did not lead to improvement as far as particular services that are. Where was the research undertaken? Who did it? And where has it been validated?
Okay. Good,
that is
good,
one area.
Good question, yeah. Okay.
So if we have a developmental role as far as investing in areas where I, as somebody in the municipality, knows that it has led to improvement. It has led to improvement as far as waste management is concerned.
Okay.
And I can...
The point I'm making, Chief, you've asked the question, let him answer you.
Good.
And then, yeah, we can proceed from there. Yes, okay. Go ahead. Go ahead, respond, because we're also in trouble with time.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to say to Councillor Johnson, we can make the research available to you. And maybe unfortunately, or fortunately, we understand Section 152, what the municipalities want to do, and what we really want to do is to assist municipalities to fulfill that developmental role. However, the conditions that we apply in giving discretionary grants, we would say, identify a project which would respond to your service delivery challenges. If you have identified unemployed in the communities as a resource you want to utilize, we will assist in ensuring that they are properly trained for the task. Two, that we will also, during the process of training and post-training, provide a retention grant to allow them, some period.
No,
I'm going to the specific.
No. Don't explain to that guy. He should know that in the first place. Okay, and I assume he does. What we want to happen is that you've researched this. You wouldn't have said that without evidence.
Okay.
What you must do, we must provide that, so that he too does not defend unacceptable practices in municipalities because it does not happen in one municipality he knows. Because that's important. We must objectively deal with that issue. If you have researched it, you have evidence about that, let's do it so that we are not seen to be approving and agreeing with things that don't exist, except fictitiously. Now, this is very useful. Thank you very much. We like we said earlier, we'll return to this area because it's an important support function in what he says the National Human Resource Development Strategy for making this sector work better and more effectively and so on. Yeah. The CRL Commission, it's your turn. Just take let me say it in the way in which I normally say it, and pardon me, let's be on our hind legs for 2 minutes, please. Let's stand up. It's been a long day. Let's take a short, allow the CRL Commission to come closer to the presenting corner here. Yeah. No. We don't smoke.
We don't smoke in Parliament. We don't smoke in Parliament. Not at all. Absolutely no, we don't. He must be a wine farmer. This is why he's speaking like this. Yeah. All right.
I'm just passing back to the office, although I'll arrive around about 4, but
okay,
I can work another 2 hours.
Oh, you can just put it on, I can put it on my desktop for me. Oops! You need just one.
Oh, sorry, is this your actual, okay, so this is yours,
not yours. No, it's mine. Which one are you talking about? The computer is mine.
What is it about? It's me. No, sir. I'm in a meeting. I'm sorry. I can't talk to you now. I'm in a meeting right now. Yeah. So, no, try me tomorrow. Tomorrow late morning. Okay. Bye. Yes. Earlier on.
Chief, go ahead.
The deputy chair will start with the overview.
Okay, right, right. So I was saying you. Yes, okay. Let's proceed, please.
Sanbonani Molweni Dumelang Tovela Nhlekani Limasiari Merak. Good day, everybody, including the chair. The commission is currently in its second term of a 5-year existence. The new commissioners were sworn in on January the 31st this year. The commission has already hosted two national consultative conferences, which is a legislative compliance. The last conference was in July 2008, and this NCC, or National Consultative Conference, is where the commission derives its programs suitable to what the cultural, religious, and linguistic communities demand of it. The challenges that we have are the following. A bigger percentage of the expectations of these communities have budget implications. For instance, the National Consultative Conference resolutions demanded provincial offices for the Commission for easy access and visibility. Additionally, the National Consultative Conference resolved that the Commission should establish a parliamentary office to trace all pieces of legislation that have a bearing on cultural, religious, and linguistic communities and be able to advise Parliament on those issues. There are resource implications for all these matters, both human and financial. A real challenge is that the Commission's budget has not increased over the previous 5 years of its existence, except for an inflationary increment. The Commission has currently no CEO, but an acting one. This followed the board's decision to put the CEO on special leave until the expiry of her term in July 31, 2009. Due to matters of performance management systems and internal controls. The Commission is currently in the filling process of the very same post of CEO. The Commission is considering a broader research on the marginalized languages such as Isimpondo, Northern Ndebele, Kilovedu, and Sipulana, with the intention of protecting and promoting their usage in teaching and learning, and also, finally, to have them as constitutional languages. These are languages that are so different to the standardized language that is used in class in such a way that the learners that are having that as their mother tongue, when they get to school, they do the standardized language as the first additional language instead of mother tongue. And you know, in the exam, they are rated according to the fact that they must pass the first language or the mother tongue. So they have a problem in that, a very big challenge in class, and which leads to a lot of higher rate of failures of learners from such languages. The research scope has been designed and would be rolled out as soon as there are finances. That is our greatest challenge. Partners in these projects will automatically be PANSALP, National House of Traditional Leaders, CARA Heritage, municipalities, and institutions where language units are established. Before I hand over to the Senior Manager Corporate Governance, Mr. Risenga Maruma, I would like to apologize for the fact that our chairperson had to be recalled back to the Commission for other obligations that he has got to perform. And I also wish to appreciate and the valued assistance that we got from the Department of Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs in trying to put our house in order. Thank you, Chair. I'll give it over to
Mr. Marum.
Thanks, Chairperson. We customized the presentation to suit the occasion in terms of induction of new MPs for them to know what this commission that is admissibly rarely known, what does it really is, what does it really stand for. The Civil Rights Commission derives its mandate from the Constitution of South Africa and the founding legislation, which is Act 19 of 2002, and the Cultural Charter of Africa on Respect for Rules, Principles and Traditions and Languages and Multiple Society, which is a continental charter. We currently have four programs, as the deputy chair said, that derived from the National Consultative Conference, where these several communities are part of. And the structure of our act provides for the conflict and mediation approach that the commission has to take in communities in cases where there are conflicts with regard to cultural and religious issues. But then the next one, that is on research and policy development, once there is a conflict that has been identified, research is then conducted by particular resources of expertise within the commission to identify the real causes of the problem, whether they are historical, whether they are just issues of hatred or xenophobia issues. Then immediately thereafter they are taken to public education and advocacy so that people are aware of their rights and the tolerance of each other in the interest of nation building. We also engage communities in terms of them encouraging them to be community councils and registering them with the commission. As we speak, there is currently a database that currently has been developed across the country. The minister, our minister, Cocktail Minister, has assisted us very quickly as soon as he assumed office by signing the criteria for recognition of the CCs in terms of the Founding Act, which currently we're rolling out with the communities in terms of what is required for them to be a CC or a cultural community council. The vision of this commission is national unity among the diverse cultural and religious and linguistic communities. The mission is on the promotion and protection of the. This mission is taken as is from the Act, which is more or less the name of the commission. The functions of the commission in terms of the Act is developing cultural, religious, and linguistic equality, recovering indigenous knowledge systems, developing an inventory on heritages, enabling communities to expand responsibility and accountability, intensifying dialogue among communities, monitoring of compliance by the state and civil society with the mandate of the Service Commission, mediation of inter-community conflict resolution and facilitate harmonious coexistence, and lobby with government departments and legislative authorities on issues concerning the rights of cultural and religious communities. The strategic objective of the commission is peace, friendship, humanity, and tolerance among communities, or CRL communities, advance mutual respect and development of diminished heritage, and of course establishment of community councils that I have just said earlier on in my opening. I have said earlier on that there are four programs, of which one of them is investigation and conflict resolution. What this program does is to first identify the nature of the complaints that the commission has received, but many of these complaints are very complex in terms of their classification. It should be either a cultural complaint or a religious nature complaint or a linguistic complaint, where you'll find that a particular community complains that that indigenous language where it is is spoken is not necessarily an official language in local schools. That particular example is currently a living matter somewhere in KZN. that the Commission is currently pursuing. Range, they also range from right of access to sacred spaces to cultural practices, initiation school versus religious activity. Somewhere in Vendai, we had a situation where a particular church was told that it was making noise during this period of initiation and that it had to cool down or to cease all activities, religious practices during that period of initiation period. So these issues of conflict arrived somewhere in Limpopo, as I said. The highest number of the complaints that we receive in terms of the trend are very much in religion. And the second highest number is about culture. And the least number is on languages in terms of currently how the inflow of these complaints are coming to the commission. And they are not necessarily in urban areas. They are in rural communities that exercise culture and religion. And in urban areas, these concerns are more in languages, in education, in terms of the trends that these complaints are coming. Currently, we have finished a research in language in education policy, and the quota to satisfy the constitutional rights of and to languages was the purpose of this research. There is more attention currently as a challenge that is paid to dual medium system, which puts more emphasis on English and Afrikaans currently, and to the exclusion of non-other languages. At issue currently is also whether Sepedi, which is understood by some to be an official language in Limpopo, particularly among Northern Sotho speaking people, whether it is a dialect or an official language. The Commission has since requested a constitutional review agenda on the matter after a robust engagement with the communities in Limpopo, because the draft constitution before this final one had Northern Sotho as Sepedi. So the current one that when it came to be finalized, it then said the official language is Sepedi, and meaning that then the Northern Sotho, which was understood to be an embracing concept of all Sotho-speaking languages in the north, was then made or replaced by Sepedi. So the Commission has currently engaged the constitutional review processes, which currently is still unfolding. In terms of research currently, we also have a promotion and protection of sacred spaces where we exercise our religious or ritual rights. It could be at the gravesides, it could be holy places where people go then and pray. The current act that promotes religious inequality, Act No. 36 of 1994 promotes religious inequality legislative review, which is what we're undertaking through the investigation and resolution program to look at this act, that we think it inhibits freedom of religious practices. We currently are also looking at the Khoisan and Rastafarian religious practices, which we think currently are also marginalized in terms of bringing them to the mainstream of religious practices. It is after we had received such complaints from organized community councils of these communities, Rastafarians and the Khoisan. There is an increased consciousness about the rite of passage, in particular in the Eastern Cape. Unfortunately, it is only also marred by misfortunes because of the death of, at some point, the initiate in terms of the rite of passage to manhood. There were factors affecting performance of the rite of passage the rite of rites in terms of the rituals. We know of the most popular case of Mr. Yengeni and the First Fruit Festival somewhere in KZN, which currently is a matter that we were engaging with the Royal House in KZN. We conducted public hearings in the Eastern Cape on male initiations because the media at some point would call it botched operations or amputations or deaths. We don't understand this amputation because there is no cut of limbs in the initiation of all sorts. In terms of the recommendations made as a result of the engagement with the communities, we agree that there is a holistic approach to address challenges like lwaluko, or incipedi is coma. I think Basotho would call it then Mopato. Chair, I don't know whether I'm as I enter your terrain. The community leadership is currently involved in terms of, I think the NHTL will agree with us that there are strategic stakeholder in these processes in terms of finding the correct remedy of protecting and promoting these cultural practices. Another program that we have is public education and advocacy that advocates very much about the awareness programs that are existing in the commission and the interface of these communities to the commission. What is it that we are dealing with? The role of culture, religion, and languages in all communities and the respect of others. The youth development, because we have identified that once we skip that area of youth development, which should be the strategic entry point in terms of mobilization of and lobbying of this awareness, we shall have lost a big time. We have also had a diversity programs in Mpumalanga and Northwest provinces. The other program that I said is the program that engages literally with the communities is community councils or consultation, which, as we had said, we currently had a signed or approved recognition council criteria by the minister that we currently are rolling out to communities in terms of what is it that constitutes a community council, what are the characteristics of a community council, and what is it that how do we help as a commission, and what is the relationship between that council and us as a commission in terms of the national agenda. We have had a dialogue with the Queensland people somewhere in Bloemfontein last year in January in the build-up to the NCC. We have identified common concern in these communities. There are flagship projects that are standing matters each year for the Commission to recognize, which are Africa Day celebrations. Very often, I think, are on the 25th of May. The Human Rights Day, or Africa Human Rights Day, on this day we undertake an educative approach in terms of the African culture and religious system in relation to language rights. Which is also a mother tongue concept. But the challenge here is, while in this process of language rights and language in education, the Commission, in its effort to promote these indigenous languages in the sector of education, in Limpopo we had some resistance big time, where you would find parents identifying the Commission as a hindrance to their children. Access to language in terms of them being very proficient in English and Afrikaans, where one Model C school, I can say we were almost expelled by the same parents whose languages we deemed to be marginalized, to say we can't, they have moved their children from a township or local school to a Model C, then we are coming as a commission to say they must learn Sepedi or Northern Sotho or Sindebele or whatever in that school. So it put us in a discourse, really, in a friction with the parents, to say, in terms of how to understand it, I think these other languages to them is equals to de-education or uneducation. I don't understand what that thing is. It's not about pride. That is where I think we should start in terms of awareness campaigns, in terms of also rebranding our languages to our own parents. We have had the National Consultative Conference, as the deputy chair had said, in July 2008. We are currently rolling out some of the resolutions that are gathered there in terms of what it is that the communities want to see in a 2.5 years time, because in terms of the legislation, our founding act requires that we have this NCC after 2.5 years of the of each term of the commissioners. We had 9 conferences in the build-up to the NCC. We have established or developed a database of several community organizations, and as we said, we have currently have the regulations for the registration for community councils, which have been approved. The purpose of the NCC is to report the progress that we have made from 2.5 years until the next NCC, and to give a national progress report in terms of policy influence as the commission on other government departments, whether there are policy issues that are impacting negatively on CRL communities. Also to gather new recommendations to chart a future agenda for the promotion and protection of the CRL rights communities. So there are key issues, the 3 key issues that underpin the NCC. Firstly is the reporting back. Secondly is to give them a national compliance report, and then to get new mandate. Politically speaking, would say it's a 5-year electoral period of government, but CRL is not is 2.5 in terms of refreshed mandate. Beyond the NCC, as I said, it informs the programs review, whether the program that we say will be able to deliver the mandate are still on course. If not, the NCC gives us a leeway to review such programs to ensure their relevance. We solicit our programs for alignment with NCC resolutions, which come out of that NCC, to say that is how we'll carve it to suit what the communities want. We also emphasize the rationale for SCC establishment to encourage communities to have these community councils and maximize communication between these communities and the commission during such a gathering. The criteria which has been signed by the minister earlier on is currently being rolled out to these community councils, so that as they constitute, they are also looking at the criteria of establishment. There are institutional partnerships with sister organizations at provincial level, particularly PANSAP and the human rights in terms of the office space also. However, the commission was necessarily not having a free ride in terms of the implementation of some of these programs. There are current challenges at hand now. As the deputy chair said, the budget constraints which refuse to leave us in terms of broadening the scope of the implementation of the NCC resolution. for example, the NCC said, you commission, you said are not necessarily visible on the ground, and what we need to have as an instruction is that we must have district or provincial offices for our reach, but that has resource implications. So we have not been able to do that. And so in terms of the mandate, we are not necessarily doing very well around visibility. There is no direct engagement, for example, between ourselves as the Commission and the National Treasury because of, I think, the institutional setup that needs to be looked at, perhaps also by this committee. The last bulletin really talks to another issue that is at hand. There is a governance model or relations that is a matter of discussion currently within the Commission, that at some point the acting DG, I think, was also informed about that as he attended one of the plenary meeting or sessions sometimes last week, that what could be the model of interaction between the DPLG and the Commission. What I think it's a cause of confusion was earlier this year when Chapter 9, all of them, received a communique from this Office of the Deputy Speaker to say if you're from the 1st of April, you will be reporting directly to Parliament. And that's it. That's where it stopped. So that's when the new commissioners were recently sworn in. So taking it on now, the question that they're asking each time when there is plenary is to say how far have we gone with the reporting to Parliament in line with the Constitution. So that is currently not necessarily addressed properly, that I think the committee should also be able to look at. Chair, thanks very much for your patience. Unlike with other presenters, you'd intervene, Chairperson, and give direction and leadership. But I think with me, these things were ingrained. Thanks, Chairperson.
There's a more mundane explanation. Okay. Any comments, questions? Sebe? Yes, ma'am.
Ga ke re modula setulo ka naka felela motlapiso ga ke tse goreya go tle bogole botlhokwa gore ke tswelele because potso e ke naganang ore tshwaelo ke na leng yone e ka re e tsenyeletsa le lefapha le le la magosi gore a na go na le tirisanommogo e e lolameng magareng ga commission-e le ntlo e ya rona ya bogosi gare ga o lebeletse ditiro tsa bone sa le lefale go na le mo dikopanang mo teng ja ka go fa sekai ka gore re le puso ra re magosi a rona ke bone ba ba tsayang maikarabelo a tsa rona tsa setso mara go na le mo dinakong tse dingwe tse o fitlhelang e le gore morafe o nna mo kgatelelong ka puso e kgosi a tlabeng a busa ka yone gore go na le Christianity ka mogare mo e leng gore morafe o tlabe o tlogile kwa lowe e le morafe wa setso mare mo kgosing e ntšha e tsene maybe mo setilong sa gare re rragwe ke motho iphitlhelana gore itse born again Christian ga a dumele mo go tsetsa setsotse go nna le mathata ke nngwe ya dilo tse di etsang gore go nne le go sa iketlang mo merafeng ya rona ka gore merafe mo nakong tse dingwe ga ba na le tetlelelo ya go etela mabitla ya go obamela ka mogo ba godileng go dirwa kate mo motseng o ba leng mo go one e tlisa fela ke a change ya gore yo o tsereng setilo se sa bogosi ga jaana ke motho e leng gore o believe thata in Christianity than mo tumelong e ba godileng ba le mo go yone gore ga go ntse yalo go diriwa jang a na le kile nana le bothata bo bontseng jalo.
That's the only question.
Ngiqinisalangathi nami ukuthi ngivumelekeleni ukuthi ngizawukhuluma lami lemsiswati. Chairperson,
on the last slide on challenges, because I've noted in the presentation when the deputy chairperson, deputy chairperson, CEO, deputy chairperson, yes, sir? Oh, okay. Okay. Then the member from the commission was saying, according to the mandate, they are not visible enough as expected. And on the challenges, you made mention of saying that it's because of budgetary constraints. And the next slide is saying not able to be direct in engagement with in National Treasury. I'm just taking them. As you are accounting to this committee, and then who is your, when you are doing your budget matters, you are presenting your budget matters to, because you are accounting to this committee, and now there's a budgetary constraint, and who's putting negotiating with the treasurer on your behalf? Because the only thing Tina, as this committee doing monitoring and oversight, we want to see you visible. Thank you, Chair.
Just a couple of things. The discussion, the presentation, the protecting of languages is obviously important, but I want to know to what extent the Commission has any involvement in the protection of sign language. There's a court case at the moment. It's gone to the it's on its way to the Constitutional Court. I'm not sure if it's there. There's a about the promotion of sign language in schools. There was it was actually brought to Parliament in the last term to the Constitutional Review Committee to have it made a constitutional language, a protected language. I don't know how far that went. But my question is, I presume a linguistic community, from your perspective, is not one necessarily restricted to the official languages. You can still be a linguistic community if it's not an official language. So if you're Portuguese-speaking, you could be a community of Portuguese speakers. So my question is, what is your role in the protection and promotion of languages other than the official languages? And I gave the sign language as an example. Then I'd like to know to what extent you were involved or not involved in the whole xenophobia story. And if you were involved, you know, how so? You know, did you hop on your bicycles and get to the scene of action as soon as possible and do things? Did you commission research or have others, you know, be doing it? I'm not quite sure what Act 36 of 94 is that promotes religious inequality. You simply said there is this act that promotes religious inequality. Perhaps you could say what the issue is. I'm missing something. One of the things I suspect, you spoke about low visibility because of budgetary constraints, but I think irrespective of that form of visibility, there's another form of visibility which doesn't rely on budget improvements, and that is your profile, or your profiling yourselves in the public media. So my issue here would be, to what extent do you actively participate in radio talk shows, on television talk shows and things of that kind, where you can promote the Commission and what you do? And then something on this Khoisan dialogue that would interest me. I'd like to know what the issue is, what the main issues are arising from that. If you take, for example, in Botswana, there's been a huge conflict between the state and the Khoisan community over their right, their perceived right, to practice a certain way of life, which is at odds with what the Botswanan state thinks their role ought to be. And there's a complete clash as to these two matters, and I wonder whether the Khoisan in this country have a similar problem or not have a similar problem, and if so, how you're involved in that. And then lastly, Chair, just two things. The Community Council regulations, I see you say they have been approved earlier this year now, and you're in the process of pursuing the Community Council. Have any yet been set up? If so, how many and what are they? And then lastly, I wasn't quite sure what you were talking about for the Chapter 9 story here in Parliament with the Deputy Speaker. I know you said they must, you know, there's an issue. I mean, Parliament hasn't engaged with that report yet. So as far as I know, there's no parliamentary recommendation of dealing with Chapter 9. And in fact, the former chair was quite scathing of Parliament not intervening to pursue the matter any further. But what was this issue that you're referring to, the Deputy Speaker calling certain Chapter 9s here and not others, etc.? I'm confused by what you said. Thanks.
Chair, I just want to know the appointment of the new board, the process
that was followed? And will you let us have the names as a committee? I want to establish how many of the old members have been reappointed. Are you totally new now? So around, you know, the appointment of the board, just some more information, please. Then on the CEO, you said there is a suspension on performance, if I heard you correctly. Is it only on that, or are there financial irregularities that needs further? Thirdly, you left it out in the one slide. I just want to know, what's the problem with the celebrating success of the Amaboko Boko? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, at the local government level, we feel that the spatial framework that we currently review must make provision for sacred spaces to be protected areas in terms of either strengthening the legislation. Those sacred spaces are either becoming either inaccessible for other land use, or it means that our communities do not have access to certain places, especially in more urbanized or peri-urbanized areas. Then the second issue is the establishment of what is termed green scorpions by the Department of Environmental Affairs. I would like to appeal that this need to include heritage wardens, so that we have a combined effort between environment and heritage. Thank you.
I'll start with the first question, and I'll leave the other questions for the senior manager. It's in connection with the relationship, kamano aringa commission ya rena le bantu ya bogosi. Er levelete tumo ya commission ya rena. Itibilana guru le mushumodi wa ogimahosi. Ga tabaja sijo, tabaja didumelo, tabaja maleni. Karoka sebeka sijo, wa baga dumelo kia beka galileni. Karuzia chibilisani. Yale, renali kamano ya mkwano le mahosi. Riseji ritomile, vyele na kwenye katomagia bilori, mudula chula vrena vaduhile, beba sunyo vaimu. Bailo vona na lukosi zelitini, gabusiyo. Kwa nongom uliga wa kikozi kake ureke abaka kona and then kwa Limpopo malova rega mgibelo riveri nilivu koshi mutapu koshi kaji mutapu bailuri baga mwarea lukuda petito la ndo ya mahosi ya kichaba vyale zaveli ya bilo ya ure unili mahosi ya mawe a hatele lao kichaba kapaka la didumelo javona gidraba ye ilo huriu gie inyaga u commission ye kawari riemele la batuwa mkwano richirele ja batuwa mkwano kosi ya sana uri iri ine didumelo javona ihadele leva vahum kari mungu limu unili didumelo javona agoje didumelo jawe bili guru eri livele didumelo jake chava rikibabisa na didumelo ya mtu ka mtu hivyo ukozi gimoruza na wona ralika uboncha kosi uri asan lo hatle la babangwe are hani akriya zo haleluya mara ake hani le babangwe e ba ke pasa kar mo le mo ne le dumelo ja o tsanjo ra be le nna mo ke za zigure ze zidisa taba no ya hore go nyake ha di office mo di province hore he ona le khosi ane le mathata o ba batho ba ine le mathata ka khosi ba kono ya o bia ga bila bila mo ofisini ya burena mo province ya yo ba i on pele ga ba ga la uthoka mabeni receive o tama li ofisi ya mkwano ile ai bona mare ri ga ba le mabeni ra tama li ofisi ya mkwano matsa mkwano ri ga bona ike ga bila hona le mangwe mathata a ya o molaone wa kumana ba ile le ndonja le tsego ene re enge be re a dzibile bile be re do ba re tsibe dore ba ile ndonja le tsego ka re mafelloni re nya ka o ke ba le dwano e tsibe o ke ba le khotano
Sorry? No, I'm not in trouble. I hear the conversation. So whoever, only the squeaky will get the oil. I assume that you guys are fine, so I haven't had any protest or request for something. What's my wonder? Hello, who are you? What are you translating? Oh, okay. No, don't talk to me. Oh, what? Now, this is a very important issue. Part of the way in which we do our work as parliament is presumptuous. Okay? Assumes that we speak the same language, all of us, okay, and that we will feel comfortable doing so. Or, in fact, if I get angry and I want to speak my father's tongue, you know, then I put someone in trouble. Yeah, okay. Yeah, but there is a significant point about the traditional leadership. Before I even translate, problem with the identified issue that this traditional leader who takes after his father or even his grandfather has converted to a religion that he now seeks to impose on the people he leads traditionally, and that's creating the conflict. Now, the commission exists precisely for that, and this is why they want provincial presence so that people can be able to have access to it for them to intervene to prevent that sort of religious conflict that he has no business to impose his religious convictions on the local community. He has as much right to practice his as they do their own. So that's basically the essence of what I'm saying. Have I done it correctly? Okay. So are you okay now? So Nobi. the researcher knew what the hell was he going to research now. Okay. Yes, that traditionally, if you were a traditional leader and you behaved that way, people left you with your brother to go and operate elsewhere if they didn't hang you. So those are the options that were used traditionally. Of course, that's not allowed today. You can't hang anybody. But they can also move away because there's no land anymore that is useful to do that. So they must find a way to resolve that conflict. So the commission exists to mediate such conflicts and to deal with those problems and so on. Yeah. Okay. Okay, responses to other questions?
Yes, may I continue, Shivalam?
Yes, please. If we can do it very briefly, we are on injury time. Yeah.
Concerning the xenophobia issue, the commission, which was during the last term, held some consultations and dialogues with communities. And they also used the youth, because if we start with the youth, they'll understand better because they're going to grow up in this situation. What was highlighted was the fact that what makes this xenophobia to get out of hand sorry, is because the people from outside our borders do not understand our way of doing things as much as we don't understand their way of doing things. For instance, when you are neighbors with people from outside and there's a death situation, you find that Bona, they don't view death in the same way as we view it. like mourning and coming to the family to show respect and say condolences and so on. But they continue living as if nothing has happened, because to them it will be death today, burial tomorrow, and everything comes to normal. While with us, we'll spend 2 weeks going to the family. Even after the funeral, we still continue going to the family to give them support and the like. Now, when they don't do, when these other people from outside their borders do not do as expected, then they are deemed to be, you know, arrogant, non-conforming, and so on. And then, because of these cultural differences, then you have xenophobia. But otherwise, if we could educate our people as to the differences of our cultures, then we could avoid such things. So a move was made towards that extent, where even the participants were asked to bring different types of cuisine, that is food, so that we share, and different clothing, so that we appreciate, you see, the Africanism in every one of us. I think that will suffice. In connection with the CEO's suspension, the contract had lapsed. In fact, it lapsed on the 31st July this year. But we gave a special leave to stay at home until that time, because there were some house cleaning progress that we were doing. And but there is some litigation that is pending. She went to CCMA and she wanted to come back, but the CRL has applied for recession. That's as far as I will say about this case. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'll give chance.
Other questions? There are of course initiatives as far as profiling issues are concerned, irrespective or disregarding the financial constraints that we are currently in. We have pending programs, Honorable, in terms of the SAB issues on diminished heritage issues, languages, and cultural challenges, of which the Deputy Chair is doing a very good job, in particular with the SAFM. So these are the other issues. But I was talking about, when we talked about visibility, we're saying beyond non-financial visibility in terms of proactively launching some of these things and recognizing some of the national days of relevance to the mandate of the Commission, including the Africa Day, as I said. So it was taking it beyond SABC and free media adverts.
For a moment, I was wondering, it's lunchtime, you're already talking SAB, are you that thirsty? So it's good that you corrected it.
The matter around the deputy speaker correspondences to us, earlier on this year, we received a correspondence from the previous deputy speaker, herself, Ms. Madela Rutledge, to say from the 1st of April, you must know that you are reporting to Parliament, and that there will be ensuing correspondences to say, this is the workshop you are on, the unit that currently I'm establishing as a deputy speaker. So that is the correspondence that we were talking about. So it was that same time that the new commissioners came in at that time. So it was part of the induction in a way. So going forward, at every board meeting or plenary meeting, members continue to ask these questions. What happened that reporting to Parliament? While reading the constitution, they're saying that we're independent from the Parliament. So where does it put us? So recently, at the recent board meeting, a particular question was asked to the DG of our department, Mr. Africa. Though it was this question that came from one board member, it has been there to a larger number of others, and it does not seem to be quelling down, because there are no answers indeed from us. Yeah. that. But you want to respond to that, Chief? Or is it something else? Okay.
Yeah. So I think this one, Honourable, you'll respond to that as you have said. There is a question, dialogue question that was asked about what the issues were. The Christian communities complained about the marginalized send languages to the Commission on issues of the SABC space or station that would be dedicated to the send communities across the board. They talked about the Kriqua communities, the Sen and the Khoi, which is different communities within the very Khoisan broader community, to say they also need dedicated schools that will teach in their languages. So it was about more of a listening campaign by the Commission and taking such concerns and taking them with the Department of Education where possible. The other question is on national treasury engagement.
Yeah. Half an hour for lunch, and then in any event, we have to wrap up with the department after that for an half an hour. Are we going on now and the food gets cold and colder? Or?
No, we're not going. We are going to come back to reflect on what we've shared. Because the wrap up is done properly, not today. We won't do it today.
Yeah.
I did say that we're not ready for your lunch. You were not here. You were absent.
No,
you were
not
here
to put
you. No,
you
were walking outside.
But I didn't know that the lunch would be only at 2 o'clock, you see. I thought the lunch.
The man is hungry. No, he's going to finish any time, yeah. Okay. All right. Complete your responses, Chief, and then we go and eat here.
Chair, I would like to respond on the process of the new board and whether old members are retained or not. And an advert came out where there was a form that was to be completed for nominations by communities, meaning cultural, religious, and linguistic communities. So they nominated, and then the person who was nominated was informed by DPLG, and then would complete a form, also send CVs and the like to DPLG. From there, there were some shortlisting, and then we were informed, and then we came for an interview on the road. And then after the interview, and then we were informed of the outcome. But there are three members from the previous term that are retained. These are Madam Bethlehem, Dr. Jobson, and Madam Leroux. So the presence of these three former commissioners helped us in terms of continuity to know where we come from and to map up the way forward, having the history of the commission. Thank you. The other question is in connection with the process of the community councils. We have just started in three provinces. I think it's Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and the Free State, where these community councils are established. But it wouldn't be a bigger. It doesn't take long to establish this because if we work in collaboration with the National House of Traditional Leaders, they have traditional councils. Automatically, they have the same criteria as our community councils. So we work in partnership with National House of Traditional Leadership. Okay.
On whether the Commission protects sign language, it is true that we protect all forms of languages, spoken, verbal or non-verbal. so long as it is a community language, which I think sign language is one of them, but we have not necessarily come across a particular complaint against marginalization or oppression of that language. I think with due respect, we'll have to take it up with the Honorable in terms of the specifics, and we'll make follow-through or follow-ups with the relevant community there. There was another question on the National Treasury engagement between the Commission. As far as we understand, the information or report from the previous CEO, the National Treasury engagement is between our mother department, which is DPLG, also on our behalf. The CFO interacts with the CFO, the DPLG, around our projections for budget next year or whatever year. But then the feedback that we get in terms of the engagement of the Treasury also is dependent on the DPLG. This is how we understand the processes. So there is with National Treasury, there is no direct engagement with the National Treasury for now. But in terms of other logistical support and all administrative necessities, including the enhancement of internal controls as the Commission, the department is assisting us a lot. It is investing a lot of resources in terms of getting us going through particular challenges that we currently are at hand, including improving internal controls. I don't think that I'm leaving any other question.
Thank you very much. The CRL Commission is doing very important work, and I haven't heard you talk about your location except through the story of Parliament. Now, Parliament, I have received a letter, I guess, on your behalf from the Deputy Speaker, in which she points out that there is the report on the ASMAL report that dealt with the Chapter 9 institutions is before Parliament. A decision has been made that a unit should be created in Parliament, which will deal with responsibilities that relates to these bodies, Chapter 9 and such constitutional bodies as is meant. But what it means is that additional work is to be made. We will be communicated with, and so as a committee, that issue will be discussed here by ourselves. We will receive additional information from the Deputy Speaker and what's going on there. But broadly also in Parliament, a discussion will ensue to deal with that issue. I think what appears to have happened is that the presiding officers decided that since these are bodies reporting to Parliament, the constitutional bodies are meant to report to Parliament, they should proceed with that. But the mechanism and how even the unit, if it exists, they have to deal with the specific individual committees to decide how that is going to work out in practice. So the practicalities are still to be worked out. It's work in progress, so there's nothing really finalized except the creation of a unit to help Parliament coordinate the interaction of Parliament committees internally with these institutions. So that's work in progress. We ourselves will get more information later so that we can interact with yourselves going forward. Ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the conclusion of our interaction with the department and the entities that report to it or work with it, to SALGA. And this is a crucial exercise. I said that we are going to... This is a... intended to help us design a program that will be budgeted for of oversight for the next 5 years. Now, okay, it will be a tentative program that we'll initially draw to be able to get the money we need, which will obviously, of necessity, be open to amendment as we firm up, as we also pick up other stuff that we would like to use. So we will discuss it as a committee first, and drafts and so on and so on. We'll come back to reflect on what we have heard in the last 2 days and what comes across as issues that require priority scheduling. We've already suggested others already in the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks and so on, but that too we will finalize. So that's where we will end. We appreciated the work you did to prepare for your presentations to us and joining us in Cape Town, those of you who don't. Thank you very much, and enjoy lunch. It's served now. Thank you, and have a happy weekend. Whatever is going to happen to you this weekend. Yeah. Yeah, no, we do that, yes. That's why I allowed you guys to have fun, yes. Yes, I was trying to complicate it, but when she was lucky, then he didn't come to the test. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, members, you have one of the civil society organizations called Isandla Institute is giving members of the committee a book on local government. It's an interesting book. So this is what has been distributed to all of you here. They hope that you'll read it. it's their view of the state of local government as and when they wrote it and so on.
It's on the brand. We don't have to declare it.
No. You've raised that money anyway. Yeah. please, you will also get an even bigger book, which is a compilation of the local government bulletin. Copies of the last 10 years have been put together into a single document. So that too is coming. So you better go and take a speed reading course so that you can cope with the amount of reading that you're going to have. Yeah.
Yeah.